first night. Go for it.
Four.
We need 4 of 7 for a quorum.
We got a quorum.
Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to our Joint Committee on Transportation and Preservation and Modernization this fine June, July 1st, my daughter's birthday, 2017. We are here today to culminate a lot of work that's gone on for the last well over a year. I want to thank everybody for all of their input, testimony, number crunching, policy writing, decision making. There's been a tremendous effort, as you all know, going into this piece of work that we want to roll out today. So we're just going to get on with it very quickly. I would like to open a work session on House Bill 2017.
Madam Co-Chair, can you share with me, I apologize, are you going to be doing immediate votes right now?
No.
Okay, just for so everyone knows, revenue and capital construction are meeting. I look forward to voting in the affirmative on your great work.
Thank you.
And so I'm going to be coming in and out, so I apologize.
Understood, sir. A number of us have similar issues.
Would it be possible towards the end, if I do miss votes, to be able to get those on the record in the affirmative?
Sir, we'll make that happen.
Okay, thank you.
We'll wait until he's here to vote.
Opening a work session on House Bill 2017.
People vote first and then be attended.
With the acknowledgement that this is a very busy day with multiple committee meetings, none of us have bills up in other committees, so if you see some of us coming in and out, don't be surprised. What we'd like to do is first acknowledge that you have the bill before you. It came out last evening. You have a section-by-section synopsis of the bill that also came out last night, and you have an executive summary. And on that note, what we would like to do, as we did in our last hearing, is turn this over to the drafters and let them walk quickly through the bill so we can understand what changes have occurred since the last amendment was reviewed. Seems like a month ago. It wasn't quite that long, but it seems like so. So I'm going to go ahead and turn this over to our very capable legal counsel to walk us through the tenets of the bill. So Heidi, do you want to begin?
Yes. Chair Byer, members of the committee, my name is Heidi Elliott. I'm a senior deputy with the Office of Legislative Counsel. I'm here today to walk through the Dash 10 amendments to House Bill 2017. The 10 Dash 10 amendments replace the current bill. And I'm here today with my co-counsel, Alan Dale and Maureen McGee. I'll let them introduce themselves, and then I will begin our walkthrough.
Chair McKeon, Chair Byer, members of the committee, I'm Alan Dale, senior deputy legislative counsel.
And Chair Byer and Chair McEwen, I'm Maureen McGee, a deputy in legislative counsel.
Welcome.
And I'll begin, section one. Just as we had in the Dash 10 amendment, section one is ORS 184.610, provides definitions for chapter 184. Section two, 184.612, regards the Oregon Transportation Commission formation. Section five is the Oregon Transportation Commission's general rule authority. Section 6 describes the Oregon Transportation Commission's functions and duties. Section 8 authorizes the Commission to enter into agreements to do things like perform transportation research and other projects. Section 9.
Question on the left, please.
Just a moment, Heidi. Senator Johnson.
If you said this, I apologize. May we stop and ask questions moving along, or do you want the questions at the end, or how do you want to handle questions?
Ms. Elliott, would it be preferable to you, if there are questions that arise, to just do them as we go through them? Are your questions are addressed to the drafters, I assume, Senator?
Yes.
Yes.
In Section 8, specify some terms that must be included in research assignments. Could you go into any additional detail on that?
So Section 8, as you know, is a shortened version of the current authority the department has to enter into OIPP agreements, Oregon Innovator Partnerships Program, and it allows the commission to also enter in agreements to perform transportation research, enter into projects, etc. And Section 8 also describes that when we enter into those agreements, what terms need to be considered.
Okay, thank you.
Section 9, the real property inventory. and a change from the dash threes is that we're talking about the inventory that's in excess of the operating needs of the Department of Transportation. Section 10 is the Continuous Improvement Advisory Committee. Section 11, we used to talk about measuring the condition of the infrastructure, and now we're going to talk about describing the condition of the infrastructure. And we changed a couple of the reporting dates, put them out a month or two from where they were in the dash three amendments. Section 12, the website.
Madam Chair.
Senator Johnson.
Given that many of us just got this last night for the first time, and we're going through it a million miles an hour, and I anticipate you're going to want a work session, I hope that you allow us a little time for some conversation.
Senator Johnson, you're very welcome to ask questions of the drafter.
I am quite curious about the how you're going to define the stakeholders of the Continuous Improvement Advisory Committee. I have Section 10 open. It says employees of the Department of Transportation and transportation stakeholders. How will those people be solicited? How will there be any guarantee of balance? How will there be an opportunity for all perspectives to be heard in what is arguably a pretty important committee given wide authority to advise the department? And I don't know whether I'm asking the drafters, because you guys are just legal scriveners,
right,
so much as I'm asking the four who conjured up this idea.
Senator Beyer.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Senator, this is, you may recall that last time you've seen this, there was much more detail in things and how this is going to be constructed, and the consensus of the group was to take that out and give general authority to the, since this is an advisory body, to the Transportation Commission to let them make those decisions. So we've complied with that and made it general and given the commission the authority to do that.
Okay, I guess I just want to set a marker in the record that in order for this committee to have any credibility or any value, if it lacks balance, if it lacks the opportunity for broad participation, and if it's stacked in any way to predict an outcome, it's pointless.
Senator, I would like to call on Representative Olson, who chaired the accountability work group. I think he has a comment to make.
So thanks, Madam Chair and Senator Johnson. I honestly get where you're at, and I understand it. And I liked what we had originally recommended because it was defined and who was going to be there. And if we're going to move forward with this, I know we're running out of time and everything like that. I would hope that the OTC would recognize what we were trying to do initially with our first recommendations and try to stay true with that as much as we could, because I was following the Colorado model. That was the thing. So.
Thank you.
Intent on the record, Senator?
I am. Pardon me?
I believe your intent is on the record.
I hope it is.
Senator,
moving on to Section 12, the website. This was a section that directs the OTC to develop a website, and there's going to be a lot of different information that's going to be on that website. We clarify that the OTC is creating this website through the help of the Department of Transportation. And in Section 12A is new, and what that does is provides that the information required from cities and counties applies for years beginning January 1, 2018, just in case they don't have that information. But if they want to provide more information, they're certainly welcome to. Section 13, cost and benefit analysis. We specify in the dash 10 amendments that the cost benefit analysis is for highway modernization or capacity building projects that are proposed for construction in the Statewide Transportation Improvement Program, or the STIP as it's otherwise known, and for projects that are estimated to cost at least $25 million. And we specify that this analysis does not apply to the projects that are specifically listed in the bill, specifically in 71A, D, F, and 120. Section 14 is the OTC's criteria list.
Representative Lively, please.
I've seen something somewhere. You're talking about what the cost benefit analysis, and what was the dollar figure you used when that is required?
I'm sorry, there's something clicking in the background. What was the question?
Figure. So
15 million.
Yeah, I was just confused because I didn't think I heard the 15 million. I'm just trying to clarify. So what's the dollar figure that's the requirement
million.
In order to do this analysis?
Or it's 15 million.
It's 15, huh?
It's on
15.
Page 12, line 25.
She said 15, that's all I'm asking.
15 million, I'm sorry, my notes are incorrect.
Okay, thank you.
It's 15 million.
Thank you. yes, Representative Swift Warner.
So while we're on that section, I just wanted to confirm. So there's
the projects that are listed in 71D as well as 71F are exempt from that cost, from that model. So the projects we are calling out in this do not have to meet any sort of cost-benefit analysis. They're exempt from that.
Chair McKeown, Chair Beyer, Representative Smith-Warner, you're correct.
Thank you.
Please proceed, Heidi. Thank you.
Section 14 describes the criteria for the STIP process, and we add a criteria consideration about whether or not a project is near aggregate mining or processing. Section 15 is the internal auditor for the ODOT, and there from the threes, we specify that the C is to consult with the Director of Transportation before designating an internal auditor. And we specify that the internal auditor is an employee of the department and reports to the director, but the director may only remove the auditor after majority vote of the commission. Section 18, we made some technical changes to the reporting on the audits. Section 19, the creation of the department, that did not change. Section 20 is the Director of Transportation's duties, and that did not change. Section 26 is the Committee on Transportation that will exist and provides that the Speaker in the House will determine the number of members and the dash amendments. We have a specific number, but the Speaker and the President will determine the number of members that will serve on the Joint Committee on Transportation. Section 27, we added a number, 27A.
Senator Johnson.
I'm sorry. This Joint Committee.
Senator Johnson, I just want to make it clear there's no intent to rush this.
It sure feels like it.
But Heidi's just walking through it, and you're welcome to interject whenever you feel.
Remember,
so
you guys have been in the room. The rest of us are all passengers on this plane.
We're happy to answer your questions.
My question about this Joint Committee on Transportation, I am looking at the section in the bill, but I am curious about whether or not it was resolved to everyone's satisfaction that the existence of this joint committee is not a usurpation of the ways and means process. And I would like a little elaboration on how the committee is going to function with respect to its interconnectivity with the traditional ways and means.
Chair Beyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator, the language that's in the bill was suggested by the co-chairs of Ways and Means, and the presiding officers, and the committee serves on budgetary matters as advisory to the Ways and Means Committee.
Thank you.
Ms. Elliott?
We added some new reporting requirements. In Section 27A, we direct the Joint Committee on Transportation to study the adequacy of funding under this 2017 Act to meet the transportation infrastructure needs of the state, and we require them to report back in 2023. Section 27C, the OTC is to conduct a study and make a report on the cost to complete the I-205 Abernathy Bridge Project in the I-5 Rose Quarter Project. 27E.
Madam Chair. Senator Johnson.
I'm sorry, you're going to be plenty sick of me by the time this is over.
Never, Senator Johnson.
Right. Anyway, the question that I have with respect, this is a 100,000-foot question, with respect to both the specified projects as well as the reporting that ODOT is being expected to do, I don't know to what degree the agency was consulted as far as the queue that they already have established in the STIP, which for purposes of my question constitutes their normal body of work. And then we're layering in over the top of it all of these projects. And I'm trying to figure out, is there a precedent that was contemplated, or will ODOT continue on the delivery of projects now in its queue? How will the projects that are enumerated in this bill sequence in to their ordinary responsibilities to on project delivery?
And Senator, since Senator Boquist was chair of the congestion work group, I think I'll let him answer this question.
To start at the first question, I think you're asking is that ODOT was in the room multiple times, and in the last week it's gone with a fine tooth comb through the existing project list you have, the future requirements. They've been working on a time phase sequence. They have roughed out those drafts of how to proceed, and the intention of the section that you're specifically asking on, which is 27C and D, is for them to be able to come back at least in two more iterations and tell us this is where we are in the planning. Here is more details we have in terms of I-205, more details we have in terms of roads border, and how we sequence those that are in right now. The six-year spectrum of the list that's in here, similar to the GATA, if you note later in the bill that the majority of those projects don't begin until about 2 years out, simply because of bonding and all the rest of that, which then allows them the timing to finish out some of the present STIP and the JTA and the present STIP. But ODOT was intricately involved in designing this.
Okay, and one more. I anticipate that as we move further into the bill and certainly contemplate a fiscal, that the committee will have an opportunity to at least hear what staff is contemplated. Is this going to be utilization of internal? Is it going to be contractors? Are there any stipulations on where the contractors come from? Is it going to be all contracted out? I think many of us have an interest in knowing that, and also, just so that people know what my predisposition is, there had been some conversations in all of the discussions about this bill that ODOT would be expected to use existing personnel. And I would hope that we would have an opportunity to talk a little bit about what staffing requirements are going to be as we move deeper into this conversation.
And, Senator, we do have staff in the room who I think can be called up once we've gone through the sections, if you don't mind, and can answer those questions.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
To that point on staffing, I mean, this is something that's been a conversation along the way as we've all been talking, both in this room, on other levels, when we've talked about staff and what it would cost to produce this package to completion. And so there are regular biennium budget conversations that we'll be having, because they will be coming to us in a biennium fashion for a 6 or 7 year plan. So we'll not only have a bite at the apple here, but we also have a bite at the apple through the Ways and Means process and through our biennium budgeting.
Representative Olson, do you have a question? Madam Chair, I'm sorry. I really want to go back to Section 26 on the Joint Committee on Transportation, if I can, just for some clarification.
Senator Johnson, are we complete on that one for the moment?
Yeah, I'm fine.
Okay, we'll go back.
You know, my thoughts are on, I thought we were going to kind of structure it similar to what we had some discussion about with the Joint Committee on Marijuana, where we had five members on each side of the building assigned by the Speaker and the Senate President. And then that it would be split. Whoever was in the majority would, you know, have obviously the majority ruling. But I don't see that makeup in that. So I'm wondering how that flows then. Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Representative, that was there. The presiding officer's position was they would rather have it more generic. Usually, okay, that kind of decision happens in the chamber rules activity, so they ask us to be less prescriptive.
So just a follow-up question.
Follow-up.
If we get to this point and everything, Representative Vince wouldn't be left out.
Well, maybe.
Okay. Time will tell, Representative. Time will tell. Any other questions?
Thank you.
All right. Ms. Elliott.
Section 27E directs the OTC to conduct a study and make a report on the cost to upgrade Southeast Powell Boulevard from Southeast 9th to Interstate 205. And I should maybe
question.
Remember a lot of what happened.
This one, a second.
Yes,
Senator Monroe.
Where's Outer Powell?
Because
that's where the work is really needs to be done.
Chair McEwen, Chair Beyer, Senator Monroe. Outer Powell is mentioned as a specific transfer and project in Section 71A.
Thank you.
D. Yeah,
thank you. So, I don't know if I'm getting ahead or behind here, but I'm trying to understand the relationship of this requirement to conduct the study with the fact that the project later is listed in relationship to a jurisdictional transfer. I'm just trying to how all this connects, because here we have a study. So if the results of the study from a standpoint of the potential cost, so what relationship does that have on later in this bill where we've listed this as one of the potential jurisdictional transfers?
Senator Boquist.
Apples and oranges. Outer Powell, which is the jurisdictional transfer, is from 205 going to the east. Mm-hmm. There is no plan for Inner Powell from 205 going to Interstate 5, and so while we are doing the jurisdictional transfer on the outer PALs in Section 71 or whatever it is out there, this specific clause right here is tasking ODOT to go back and look at, in the future, how would we transfer inner PAL, which is I-205, back to the river. Totally different. One is inner PAL, the other one's outer PAL.
Okay.
If I might be.
Yes, Representative Leiden.
So, but this call...
This call's from Ninth, Southeast PAL at 9th Street, which is Rhodes Quarter, out to I-205.
Okay.
It's basically the Ross Island Bridge to 205.
I'm still not satisfied, but go ahead and I'll figure it out as we go. It's all right.
You better...
Could staff help clarify?
I yield to it.
Senator Monroe, did you have something else to add?
No, I just wanted to make sure Outer PAL wasn't being forgotten.
It is not.
Thank you.
Okay. Ms. Ellie.
As you may remember, a large part of what we did in the first 26 sections is to reorganize and consolidate lake sections so that the formation of the OGC, for example, isn't spread over six sections. It's done in one section. And as a result of that, there are some repeals and some renumbering, and those conforming amendments are found in sections 28 through 30. Next, move on to our next major chunk or topic of the bill, which is highway maintenance, preservation, and seismic upgrades. In section 32, we have our miles per gallon base registration fee surcharge. But instead of taking it out to 2026, we're going to take it out to 2022. And that's what you'll see in sections 32 and 33. Section 34 and 35 increase the light.
Wait.
Senator Johnson.
I noticed the accommodation for the Origo program, one of my personal favorites, and I'm just curious what the status of that program is right now. We asked to have these owners registered in a program that last time I checked only had about 700 subscribers, and when they were anticipating 5,000, I have no idea what the status of that program is right now. And if you connect the charge for electric vehicles, it appears to be an exemption. I don't know how this is working.
It's a choice.
Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The idea is that they can either pay that amount, which is the amount that corresponds to the average cost that a regular car would pay, or they can choose to pay by the mile through the Origo program.
That's one way to build the numbers.
Madam Chair.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Thank you.
Representative Smith-Warner.
So thank you. So the stuff in 27, in Section 27, as well as what you just mentioned about the changes, the surcharge is only going to 2022, is the idea that this is a six-year package then, and that we're going to come back in 6 years and do this again? Because I was struck by that in the when the committee is going to report back in that language. Because one of the things we have talked about a lot is the idea of not just doing packages every 6 years, and that originally.
Representative McClain.
I think that from the last time we saw it in this full committee, there has been a change of venue in the sense that we did have a 10 to 12 year concept that has been taken down to a 6 to 7 year concept, and that we have a package that has come down about $2 billion or $2.4 billion in size. So we have to come back when we need more for some of the project concepts for the years 7 through 12. But it's been done for a number of reasons, including segmenting projects, including trying to set up some actual backroom value pricing, I guess I would call tools, to really deal with actually having the ability to do years 7 through 12 of the plan. So I think it's important to realize that we made a choice in this last 2 to 3 weeks that we were going to narrow it, and that we were going to make it shorter, and that we were going to have a smaller package with all of the components that we care about intact, which is the balanced transit, bike path, safe pathways to school, and also maintenance and modernization projects. So what you're looking at is a concept that is shorter, but it has all the components that you care about.
And Representative Smith-Warner, you'll notice there's a revenue report in your stack of documents, mm-hmm. and it shows the increases out to 2024. So it's in essence.
Okay.
And that does include also the title and registration fee increases as well, which grow significantly over time. Representative
So Martin. With all due respect, and I appreciate all the work done on this, but I... we made a choice isn't necessarily how this happened. This does not mean I don't agree with the choice, but the way this process has worked, and now we're here with a huge bill in front of us to try to take actions. I just want it from my perspective to understand this is not the ideal way that I would have done this, and so I'm just concerned when we say we made the choice to take it from 10 years to 6 years or something. That's not necessarily how it occurred. We may decide to have done that by agreeing to this, but we didn't make the choice to change the plan for that.
Noted.
Thank you.
Ms. Ellie.
Yes. Sections 34 and 35 amend the current registration fees, including the constitutional requirement for proportionality. So a lot of the numbers you see in there are for heavy truck vehicles. That these increases also need to reflect the light vehicle payments that have increased. In sections 37 and 38, you'll see the tiering surcharge for title fees. Those also only go out to 2022. And if you skip all the way down to section 40, because sections 39.
Give us a sec to move forward in the bill.
39A.
There's a lot of pages to turn here.
Are only conforming amendments.
Wait, are we jumping now from 27 to 40?
No, we're skipping from 38 to 40.
Okay, I want to go back and talk a little bit about section 34.
Senator.
Section 34 came as a bit of a surprise to some of us that were not in the room. And I think that we should not pass over lightly the number of increases in fees that this contemplates. Back in the first iteration of this bill, we were talking about license and reg, and now this lays out with a certain degree of precision just who all we're hitting. And I think this is, once Oregonians have the opportunity to kind of contemplate this, I just don't want to pass over lightly. This is a significant number of fee increases, mm-hmm. Including, I would call out, on antique vehicles. A certain member of our household collects those, and when he sat down and figured out how much this is going to cost him, not a happy camper. And so I just don't want to pass over a significant part of this bill lightly.
Senator Boquist.
I'll just add to it and try to add a little bit of clarity. When you take the basic construct that we had of tiering and the values you had, and then you proportionally in legislative revenue apply to the fees, this is their proportional share of each of those as we go out. And yes, as a farmer, I see things that I don't like either, unfortunately, in this. And so I would agree with you. Some of them definitely jump out, and there's always the opportunity to come back in February or at a later point and say, okay, this one didn't work out if we did it proportionally. What legislative revenue tried to do is, if I recall correctly, there's something like 146 different titles and registrations. And if you remember here, we did at least 2 years of tampering with them, which makes almost 300 calculations. And, of course, this is by cost share analysis how they flow out. Some, of course, do jump out, like the antique vehicles jumps out seriously across the board. So I would concur with you that while they do, some of them really jump out, and the possibility of coming back and, of course, addressing them in February, which this committee will still, if we vote on this and exist, we will all still exist in February to make any technical changes we need to make.
I appreciate that explanation that this is proportional, that these weren't just capricious dollar amounts chosen by the four of you.
No.
I have a clearer understanding, but I think that this will benefit from some more thoughtful review, just as Senator Boquist suggested, because we've managed to annoy huge segments of Oregon here.
Madam Chair.
Well, and Senator, we can direct staff to start keeping a list of those things that we might want to revisit as well in 18.
15.
We've already
yes. And Madam Chair, I would remind us that in our transportation committees, every biennium, we also get a report from ODOT that explains what the fees are and how much it costs to actually, you know, deal with some of this administration and some of the work. So there's an opportunity through that process also to review fees.
I'll resist the, no, I'm not going to resist the temptation to say some of those fees haven't been adjusted in a long time, and the fact that ODOT is selling below cost and making it up in volume is not acceptable. But that's another story.
There's actually a bill, Senator, that is waiting to be passed that talks about an adjustment in those fees and actually paying for those fees, but it's not here.
What page are we on, Heidi?
Yes,
I think we've got page 6.
108.
Section 40.
Which is section?
Section 40.
Welcome, Mr. Dale.
Thank
is it
you.
Your turn now?
Yes, briefly. Alan Dale, Senior Deputy Legislative Counsel. Sections 40 and 41 increase the gas tax by 4 cents beginning January 1, 2018. Sections 42 and 43 increase the use fuel tax by 4 cents beginning January 1st, 2018. Section 45 provides additional 2 cent increases in both the gas tax and the use fuel tax for calendar years beginning January 2020, 2022, and 2024. If the Oregon Transportation Commission submits a report stating certain specified facts.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Johnson.
We use the term in here. I'm going from the summary. I probably ought to look at the specific bill language, but we use the word shovel ready. And I'm struggling to know if in the main big bill there is a definition of shovel ready. Does this mean, and Victor's shaking his head, no. I'm trying to figure out, does this mean environmental issues have been resolved, lawsuits have been resolved, title is resolved, the project is ready to proceed, and just how much elasticity there's going to be in the description of a, quote, shovel ready project.
Do the transportation.
Yeah, I'm looking to Mr. Dale or to someone from ODOT who might have a clearer definition.
Yeah. We use the term all the time, but
yeah, but none of us know what it means.
Well, you're the subcommittee chair of transportation.
I don't know what economic development means.
Well, Madam Chair, and I had jotted down a question about this section as well, which was to me, is this also another? Does that whole coming up with the list of shovel ready when we figure out what that means? Does that mean another opportunity to draw up another project list like is in this bill now?
That is not the intent.
That's not the intent. Shovel ready.
It is not the intent?
The project is ready to go to construction, go to bid.
Okay, so that means all the design work has been done, all the right-of-way acquisition.
Senator,
excuse me,
I'm going to invite Director Garrett up. We have someone here who may be able to answer this.
Yeah, I think
that's what he said. He just nodded. It means it's ready to go to bid.
The intent of this section is they don't come up and tell us they want money for something that doesn't exist. They come up and say, here's what we're going to do in the next 2 years. It's ready to go. So Ways and Means then knows that we have 18 projects that they need to proceed with bonding for.
Mr. Garrett, thank you for joining us.
Madam Chair, Senator Johnson, I think Senator Beyer and Senator Boquist answered the question correctly. We have cleared all those hurdles, those encumbrances. We are ready to take the project to construction.
Follow-up. So does that mean that all the projects that we have listed in this bill are also shovel ready?
No.
Madam Chair, Representative Smith Warner, no, there are different stages of maturity. So we will bring them, and Senator Boquist spoke to a sequence of timing that'll play itself out over the life of the bill. Some projects are ready to go or very close to. Some will play themselves out in the outer years as we continue to inform, bring it through design, preliminary engineering to construction.
That's okay.
Never mind. For the record, that description that you just gave was of the projects in this bill before us.
What
that they are
said,
not yeah. all shovel ready. They are in various stages of design. And so, and therefore, it may be that just because the project is listed in here, it will not. not come to fruition because it will not make it, its way through that process.
It will, more than likely, it will mature through the process and we'll get it to delivery. That is the glide path toward delivering a project.
But having it in here is no guarantee that it will actually go into construction.
It's a fair statement. There may be some
issues. Senator Beyer, and then Representative Vance.
If I may, the intent is that they will go to construction. It's a question. It's not a question if they will. It's when.
Correct.
Unless something, I mean, there's always a chance that something will pop up that means you can't do it. But that's true anytime you have a construction project.
But
that is not the intent. The intent that they will be built during the life of the program.
Started.
I shouldn't say completed, but.
I think this particular part of the conversation could be assisted if Senator Boquist could explain the nature of Section 45 and how the, or what the department's being asked to do by the commission in light of the anticipated possible increase in the gas tax.
Sure. First off, if you'll recall, the original draft of this committee in the future was to take on ways and means type affectations, and that was decided by the beings above us and everybody else, and for logical bonding reasons in which, you know, to consolidate financial purposes. What the intention of the section is here is that before we increase the gas tax, before, and you could call it sort of a trigger, but it's not, it's a report to the legislature that provides the adequate information to the legislature that says in the next 2 years we have these 16 projects ready to go. That then allows joint ways and means downstairs, because we're using a single consolidated bonding program in the state of Oregon now, in which to say, so Mr. Garrett can come up and say, I need $267,000 in bonding authority in the next 2 years to complete these projects that are in here to go forward. And the information and reporting information from the Oregon Transportation Commission in these areas is designed to tell us that they've gone through the steps, they're ready to go, and we want the legislature, you're on notice, Oregon Transportation Commission has said we're going to increase the gas debt, it's going to go forward, and then what transpires is the legislature is in possession of the information on an annualized basis, and in this case every 2 years basis, that we then can turn around and do all the bonding steps in a consolidated process that we have. That's the entire intent of this section. It does not delegate any authority for the legislature. I do want to touch base on to remind everybody that while we are, of course, you know, legislators this session, we can't bind a future legislature. So 2 years from now, somebody could, in fact, change this. 4 years from now, someone could, in fact, change this. Or we could all have buyer's remorse and change it in February, in theory. I mean, those are the sequences that are out there. This is designed to set an entire process that we can logically step through so that we don't come back. And if you'll note here, this does go out 7 years, not 6 years. And when you get out to 6 years and you're actually implementing the next tax phase, you're now implementing projects that will go 2 to 4 years beyond that, because some of those projects in year six are going to be 4 to 5 year projects. So it's sort of not quite accurate to say it's a 6 year or 7 year plan. It actually will extend farther out.
Representative Benz.
Yeah, I just want to say that I thought this was a clever way of building on the accountability piece that we talked about a few 20 minutes ago, and the concept of shovel ready, as used in this particular section, has everything to do with the department coming forward and showing why it's going to be necessary to see that increase in the fuel tax that we built into the bill. I think it helps us go to the taxpayers of Oregon and say, hey, we just haven't turned the department and the commission loose. We put the these checks into the process, so that we can justify these increases that are further down the road. So it's a very, very clear, I think, means of explaining to the people of Oregon that the department and the commission are going to be more going to have to be more accountable to this body.
Senator Johnson,
I want to follow on where Representative Smith Warner left off, and my curiosity is, in looking at the project list, some of these are going to be incredibly complicated projects. I'm not picking on Southeast Powell, but I'm thinking there's going to be right-of-way acquisition. Undoubtedly, some of that's going to be litigated. The question that I have is, how long can projects stay on the to-be-built list and suck up valuable bonding capacity before somebody says, you can't get there from here. And I'm not saying that you can't get there from here on Powell, but I'm just saying some of these are going to require very delicate negotiations. And I don't know how many bonding tranches they move through before somebody finally says, this project cannot succeed.
Senator, I think that will come back before this Joint Transportation Committee once it's formed. And I'm going to look to the director to quantify a little in more detail, but I think that will be the job of us at the end of the day.
I think, Madam Chair, Senator Johnson, legitimate issue. No, we won't bond.
Excuse me, colleagues. I'd love to hear Director Garrett's answer.
Senator Johnson, we will not bond and accrue debt until we have everything cleared. So whether it's one $480 million tranche or several, those will be conversations that we have with the Treasurer's Department. But we will only bring forth, as was mentioned earlier, those projects that are ready to go to be bonded so we can deliver it. We'll continue to work. You're exactly right. There are some very complicated projects, negotiations. But I will tell you, if past is prologue, very few of those go to litigation. We usually close the books, we move forward in those critical path type issues to deliver the project. But we won't lead with our chin on any of those projects.
Let me just say, I shouldn't have used litigation so narrowly. Your agency over the past decade has developed a community engagement process that is nothing short of robust.
Yes.
And getting to yes on some of these projects may be more or less difficult depending where in the state they are and what the enthusiasm is to move forward. And I'm just trying to get a sense of how long they will linger before somebody, and I don't know who the somebody is, I'm deducing from what you guys said, the somebody could be the legislature, pronounces the patient expired.
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Johnson, I think there may come a point where if we cannot, reasonable people cannot agree, then we have to come back to this committee and say we have exhausted all the avenues and can't come to closure.
Okay.
Senator Byer.
Madam Chair, I would add, Senator, that ODOT and the legislature has a lot of experience with that in the last decade. We went through three rounds of OTIAs and JTA, all of which were much more complicated than most of these. It's not to say that something can't go wrong, but I think the department has a lot of experience in delivering on legislative priorities.
Well, Senator Byer, I appreciate that. Madam Chair, Senator Johnson, very quickly, you know when things go bad. We had a seaside experience where a community changed and that community walked away from $38 million. So things do happen, but they are the exception. They are not the rule. There is a discipline protocol that we follow to deliver projects.
Thank you, Director. Representative Smith-Warner.
Thank you. Because I would just like to throw out as my example of a project in this package, which is retrofitting one of the bridges in Salem. I'm pretty sure that is not anything out yet. Maybe it is. Maybe I'm just not aware of it. But that's a large, significant project that does sound like it'll take a lot of engineering and work. And so I guess I'm following on Senator Johnson's of, is there an expiration date? Is the authority in this, you know, until the end of time? Is it if we get to the end of the 6 years and we're still in engineering? Does the authority for that go away? Does it last forever? And I'm not sure it's really fair to ask you this question, Director Garrett. I think maybe it's more of we have to figure out what our legislative intent is. And it looks like Senator Boquist might have some thoughts about that.
Representative Bences.
If I may, and Heidi would have to answer this. Thank you, Madam Chair. On page 149, I know as to the projects that are called out in the bill, and I think Powell's is one of them, the bill states, line 14, page 149, no later than January 1st, 2024, the commission shall allocate. And I had viewed all of this as a six-year window within which this had to happen. And if it couldn't, then you guys would report back to us and say, didn't work. Now, that's how I had been interpreting that time frame within which this was supposed to happen. And I think we've discussed that before, but am I right?
Senator Boquist.
That is correct. And beyond that, what we did in the JTA is we said, go forth, do all these things, and come back and tell us when there's a change if you need help.
Mm-hmm.
We've done the exact opposite in this because we're forming this committee permanently and said, you will come back first in February of next year with Plan A. You will then come back 2 years from now with Plan B. You then will collect 2 years with Plan C, and this legislature, instead of waiting for ODOT to OTC to come back, is directing in this bill to come back first in 1 year and then every 2 years until completion, and tell us where are you at, what are you doing, which projects are moving, and what bonding authority do you need to do those projects, so we can transfer that to Ways and Means to do it. We're actually adding 2 year oversight over the next 8 years in this bill versus JTR, where we handed them and said, come back when you're done.
Senator Johnson.
It raises one other interesting question that this exchange has caused me to think of, and that is, what's the expectation about ODOT's role in bringing some of these projects to culmination? Let me go back to Representative Smith-Warner's example of the bridge, only because that involves a municipality, it involves state agencies, there are going to be significant environmental impacts to that. Is the expectation that ODOT is lead on cobbling together all of these pieces and finding the other fiscal partners if $60 million, if that's the number, isn't adequate? If that's the case, and we are now asking ODOT to shoulder the burden of designing, negotiating, overseeing all of the aspects of each one of these projects, that is a monumental amount of work. Mm-hmm. And I don't know what you're contemplating. In some of these, is it the jurisdiction? Let's take Salem.
Salem is already wanting to do this, so go ahead.
Oh, well, I'm just using Salem as an example because Representative Smith-Warner brought it up. So is Salem then on the hook to design the project, get the right-of-ways, do all of the lead-in work, or is the expectation that we just say to ODOT, get us a bridge?
That's a state-owned bridge.
Farther along in the bill, when you get to it, it identifies who's the responsible authority in each of these projects.
Okay.
Director Garrett.
Very quickly, Senator Johnson raises a good point, and this is probably an issue that can be addressed during a technical corrections. But there, you give certain authorities to the commission and to the agency. Some of the charge within the bill are a local government's responsibility. But the way we can interpret it is we may be responsible for that. So I think clarity of what you have just articulated, Senator, is something that maybe in February we come up and clean up through a technical correction to ensure that the commission, with its authorities, with everything that they do control, or the agency, we will deliver on those requirements in those even years of 2022 and 24, those requirements or triggers, whatever term you want to use. But how do we ensure those folks that we really have no authority over, local government to some extent, that they are meeting their obligations as well? We can certainly do it through persuasion, the risk of maybe losing a project, but that's a little piece of work that I think we need to do, and it may extend itself out into a technical correction conversation later.
Okay. Thank you. Further? Mr. Dale, I think you're back on.
Are we still in section 45? I lost track.
Mr. Dale, can you direct us to where we left off, please?
I'm done. We should be on page 117.
Okay.
With section 48.
So I have another
Representative
question.
Lively, and where are you referring
to?
So
I'm on page 114, and okay. Maybe other places. I don't know. But it's talked, if I'm reading this correct, it's those things that have to be met before the next 2 cents increase would be would go forward, and one of them says is to the best of the knowledge of the commission, all bodies scheduled to receive the fuel tax revenue pursuant. So I'm trying to understand what this all bodies means, and if not all bodies are doing it, does that mean then that the increase would not occur?
Legal counsel can give you a technical answer to that, but it's a reporting requirement. That's what it is. It's a reporting requirement. It's not the only thing that you can retire, and Mr. Dale will then jump in. The only thing you can do is require the OTC to give us factual information or tell us what they've done. You cannot set up a mechanism in which there's, for a better word, hold accountable in there. And in this particular section that's in there, there is probably a technical change we need to address in February to make it work right.
Thank you.
Okay? But, Mr. Dale, I think you can identify that we cannot explain that we, how I guess the layman's term, for the record here, triggering really works.
So the Legislative Assembly cannot delegate its legislative authority, but they can delegate to an administrative agency a reporting requirement so that they report back to the legislature that certain facts or circumstances exist, and upon that report, the the statute that is conditional upon the existence of those facts and circumstances becomes operative. So that's what's happening here. And in this case, it is, there are three parts. I mean, the commission simply has to report that the bodies are in compliance or under review by BOLI for compliance, or the OTC itself has requested from BOLI confirmation of the compliance. So it isn't as much of a hair trigger as it sounds. It really is requiring the OTC to report on the status of its own supervisory position with respect to this issue.
Good questions. All right, moving on, sir.
Maybe not. Sections 48 to 70. These are all the heavy truck fees that also have to be increased proportionally.
Could you comment on, before we just pass over this, the you said that
Senator heavy, Johnson, I'm sorry, where are you?
I'm on section 63, page 9. Just Heidi was starting,
you.
I mean, Ms. Elliott was starting to move through these. And it sounded like we were going to just announce that this was the impact on weight mile. What exactly is the impact to the trucking industry on this bill in its current form? Are they taking how their weight mile shifts around given the construct of this bill right now? Is this a
Senator Johnson, I might interrupt and invite Mr. Malik up. There's a table that you have in front of you that's a revenue report that may answer that question. Mr. Malik, would you care to join us for a moment? That might be helpful.
Was this sent out, or is it just placed on our desk today?
It had. Did it go out, Pastor?
It's on OLIS, okay. Madam Chair. Yes.
Thank you, Mazen.
Chairman McEwen, Mazen Malik, Legislative Revenue Office. And Senator Johnson, I think you're asking about what impacts, as in weight mile rates and other truck registrations, and it, the way this implementation of this bill have concentrated all the truck on heavy vehicle fee increases in the weight miles category that includes weight mile road use assessment fees and so on, and did not go, for an example, to the registration fees or the commercial registration and so on. That is something that the industry have requested, that they direct their fees on that category itself, and that's what we've done.
Madam Chair, respectfully, Mr. Malik, you speak fluent revenue, and I'm going to ask that we try to translate this into English. I'm a truck driver. How bad am I going to get hit?
Oh, you're a truck driver, and we love you for what you're going to do.
Or you love me for what I'm going to pay. I'm trying to figure out what's the impact on the drivers in my district.
The impact comes out to about 53.3% increase in the weight mile tax.
What? Over 50%? 53% increase in weight mile?
Yes, Senator Johnson. That's over the time allowed for the different increases, the last occurring on January 1st, 2024. So you have 25% going, and if you have this sheet in front of you, you have on January 18, you're going 25% up, and then 2 years of nothing, and then you're going 5% up to 131, and then in 22, another 5% to 145 total, and then 6% in January 2024, reaching 53%.
So only 6 years.
Okay, so for our negotiators, the follow-on question is, you know, there'll be three trucks left with these kind of increases. I know that you spent an awful lot of time negotiating, but I'm trying to figure out how I go home and explain to truckers in my district that between now and January of 2024, they're going to take a 53% increase, well, averaged.
Senator Johnson, the way this, if you look at the different sections of what we have in the revenue report. You know that the total impact of this package on all this revenue sources that we have considered, meaning state sources, state fees, in total, everybody, if everybody was paying the same, everybody would go up by about 46.5%. So this is the total increase of the package. The trucking industry has different tools to come up to that 46%. The two most important or the biggest tools that they do is the weight mile tax and the registration fees. They chose to use only one of those tools, and that's why it's 53% rather than 46.5%.
Okay, so just for clarity, this was an industry selection. This was the methodology that they wanted to participate, and I see nods in back. This was their choice to use one of the two tools in their toolbox.
One of the two biggest tools in their toolbox. Yes, Senator Johnson, that is correct.
And, Senator, I think it's important to note that at 12:15 today, I received an email, as did Senator Byron Boquist. It just arrived, and I'm just looking at it, that the Truckers Association is supporting this package.
That's very helpful information.
Yeah, they wanted to inform us that after a lengthy discussion this morning with the OTA board, they've elected to support the Dash 10 amendment to House Bill 2017 and appreciate the hard work we've all put into the bill and our willingness to work with them regarding their concerns around it.
Would it be too much to ask that we all get copies of it?
Yeah, I just saw it. It just, I've been on the floor. I will forward it right now as we speak.
And Co-Chair McEwen, Senator Johnson, one last thing I have to say. You know, while we were doing all these rates, and I said the weight mile part of it is the road use assessment fees and the flat fees. Some of the rates that we had going towards the 2024 and so on were slightly misaligned, and I think we probably, these are one of the issues that we will take up in February to fix, although we have time, these are small. And just wanted to be on the record that and this does not take a 3/5 vote. That's just a simple majority.
Just an email.
Mr. Malik, you just made reference to we'll take up in February. I've probably heard that phrase 10 times since we got here. To the four negotiators, are we contemplating something in February? Is this planned, or is this just kind of maybe we'll get together and maybe not?
Senator, I think it's fair to say that in the last week and a half, there are a number of things that have changed. Ledge Council's been working very, very hard, as have the editors, as have Mr. Malik, to try and get caught up with this very large document. And I think it's fair to say that there may be some things that we're going to need to come back and tweak. After the joint committee is formed, I think it will be our job to go ahead and, as any legislation that comes through us, if there's things that we need to make adjustments to, we will. But I think particularly because of the detailed nature of this, there may be some things we need to come visit. So I would like to, and Patrick is doing that, starting a list of things that we want to come back and make sure that we're paying.
So that's a yes, we're contemplating working this in February again.
Let's be clear, Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We are not contemplating
redoing the bill.
Redoing the design of the bill.
But
we
just
expect that there will probably be some little things that we didn't quite catch. Technical issues, some of which you've heard Council has talked about that always happen anytime we pass a bill. We are always back fixing it in the next session.
I would just like to request that, you know, you talked about getting a support letter from the truckers, and I heard also AAA. I would like them both or any others to be shared with the members of this committee.
I just received this. I'm sorry, we've been on the floor all morning.
I know, but I'm just saying, as you receive support letters from the industry, I would like to think that other members of this body would love to have.
Sure. We'll have Patrick post this to all of us right now. If others come in, we will certainly post them for you.
Please.
Mr. Dale. Thank you, Mr. Malik.
I have to ask for stuff.
I believe it's my turn.
Okay.
Back to Heidi.
Chair McEwen and Chair Byer, members of the committee.
What page are you on, Heidi?
Section 71A.
Section 70. And what page?
Page 146.
146. Thank you very much.
This is the section that distributes all of the revenues raised from the gas tax, registration fees, title fees. And what it does is, off the top, starting in 2022, $30 million will be used for the Interstate 5 Rose Quarter project. And $10 million off the top will be used for the Safe Routes to School program. After that, the monies will be split 50-30-20, 50% for the state, 30% for the counties, and 20% for the cities. And the amount received by ODOT, the first $10 million will go to highway safety. The remaining amount will be split in the following ways: 40% for bridges, 30% for seismic upgrades, 24% for maintenance and replacement of state highway pavement and culverts, and 6% for state highway maintenance, preservation, and safety improvements. In 71B, we double amend again 71A to increase the safe routes to school monies to $15 million a year. And that will start in 2023. Yes. 71D, this section provides the allocation for each region of the state. There are five ODOT-created regions, and they're described in ORS 366805 earlier in the bill. It describes the list of projects that will be completed in each of those five regions.
Mr. Chairman, Senator. Are these listed in any order to suggest preference of delivery?
No. They're listed purely by region, starting with region 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, in no order of preference. OTC will determine the priority.
And one other question. In some cases, there are pedestrian safety called out. That's above and beyond the safe routes to school? Those are different projects away from school zones, or?
Yes, they are.
Okay.
Was that a yes?
That was a yes.
In addition to. Okay. So.
Furthermore.
Representative.
So my question remains, and it doesn't have to be answered today, but I appreciate all these projects and the amount of money. I'm still trying to understand. So what happens? So how much other money, new money, is available to do projects that aren't on this list and that may come up or already on other lists out there between now and the end of this cycle? I can't ascertain that from these lists and the amount of money. I'm at loss to where what the other money is that's available that's new money. It's available to do state projects that aren't these projects listed here.
We'll get that to you. I don't have it off the top of my head.
Could you get that to the whole committee?
Yes.
I think we all have an interest in the answer to that.
That's as close as thing.
There's also, you have this in your stuff, Representative Lively, that actually has a breakout of it too, but we can get you the more detailed one because it was analyzed.
That would be good. The section also specifies that when a project is finished and is completed under budget, that the commission shall reallocate the monies to another project in the same region. And then once the region's projects are completed, the commission may reallocate those monies to another project on the list.
Just for clarification, Mr. Chair, so that means within that region, they don't have to come back to the legislature, the OTC, to reallocate that money to projects?
Correct.
Mr. Just for clarification, they do have to come back for bonding authority every 2 years, right?
Right.
So there is another check. They can reallocate, but it's only in 2 years. And the other thing for clarification, keep in mind that there are bonding restrictions. When you go out to bonding, you learn a lot in this committee. You go out to bonding, you can't go out and actually spend it on something that wasn't on your bonding list. So there's a whole sets of checks and balances.
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can I ask a question? Are we to 71F yet, or not quite? I don't want to jump ahead. Are we to the multimodal project list, or not quite yet?
I was going to move on to 71F.
Great. I'll ask before you answer then. Can I ask a similar shovel-ready question about these four projects as I asked about the other projects? Which is
where
two of them
you?
Seem much very specific, and two of them seem very loosey-goosey.
71F.
71F. There's four multimodal projects listed on 154 and 155. Mid-Willamette Valley Intermodal Facility, Treasure Valley Intermodal Facility, and then rail expansion in East Beach Industrial Park at the Port of Morrow, and Extend Brooks Rail Siding. Now, C and D sound very specific. And the other two don't.
Because these.
The Mid-Willamette Valley is a very long area, I would argue. So I guess I just wanted to get a sense of if they're, how shovel ready are these? Are these projects that are designed? Are they located?
You had a chance to visit that when we were down in Albany back in October last year. It was the Millersburg site up north. Or do you remember that?
No, I don't think you were there. I don't think I was in the Albany.
Yeah, okay,
I think
so
that was the one that I
we've done a lot more exploration on that whole thing. But
nice
job,
Olson.
Yeah, you have two tracks that are Union Pacific on one side that run parallel to the property and I-5. Now, all of a sudden, we've come to learn, too, that there's BN over on the other side of the highway. We do have a business plan that's in place right now to move forward with it. It's just a matter of fact of getting the support from the state, some investments from some other local community business. We could get going.
But so it is a project that there's a location proposed, there's a plan, there's and I know I've heard more about the Treasure Valley one.
And there's also 2 years to put it together.
There's, in the bill, there's language that the 2 years or the priority expires.
Okay. Moving on. Section 71H to 71K, related to the Department of Transportation's authority to issue highway user revenue bonds. But that authority does not begin until 2020, and that's for a maximum amount of $480 million. Section 71L is the department's requirement to submit.
I'm just trying to understand. So we jumped to bonding authority, and I thought you heard you say something about the maximum amount they could bond.
Yes.
Is that what I heard you say?
71I, which amends 367620, can be used for bonding authority after $480 million. But remember, this process still has to go through joint ways and means.
Yes. Just
that. Welcome to the joint ways and means process.
So is that the maximum within the range of this, the total, the 6 years in that, the maximum potential bonding is $480 million?
That is the number that we've received from the agency right now that they would need.
Well, that's what they would need.
Right. At this point, in current dollars, they will have to come back each biennium and each session to the joint ways and means process. How the reporting mechanisms once is they will come to us and say, here's what we're going to do in the next 2 years, or here's our upcoming for this year. We would then obviously have our ability to influence that. Then ways and means process on the bonding authority, their bonding on a biennial basis will be rolled into the existing joint ways and means process. So they could come back and say, and they've said in this 2 years, they do not need bonding authority in the next 2 years. They will come back following biennium and say we need X millions of dollars, whether it's 160 or whatever it is. They will come back and advise us. What we're authorizing here is their planning number of the $480 million. The, at present dollar values, they have a series of these projects they've already identified that they will do with cash flow.
So the only follow-up question I have then. So this is just based on what they've identified as potential needs. It's not based on capacity to bond.
Nope. It's not based on any capacity to bond.
Thank you.
Okay.
Section 71L requires the Department of Transportation to provide quarterly and biennial reports to the Legislative Revenue Office. Section 72 through 74 have not changed. They are the small and city-county allocation increases. Section 75 and 76 have not changed from the Dash-3 amendments. This is a requirement that the OTC conduct a study to determine whether users are powered by different means are paying their fair share, and if not, provide recommendations for legislation. Beginning with Section 77, we start talking about the Connect Oregon program. Lottery bonds will be handled in a different bill than the bond bill, so that's no longer in the Dash-10 amendments. In Section 79, we made some clarifications that public bodies, private entities other than Class 1 railroads shall provide a 30% match in order to receive Connect Oregon grants, and that Class 1 railroads shall provide a 50% match.
This is a
Senator Johnson.
We're pretty close to the end of the session. I don't know whether there has been any articulation of what Connect money may be available. This is kind of nebulous. It talks about if less than $75 million later in the bill. could we get a little more explanation about how this is all going to work?
Yes. And I am happy to address this issue because this is the one part of the, I think everyone has a piece of this bill that they are delighted to see in here and other pieces that they are not so excited about. This is one that I am sorely discouraged about. It's my understanding at this point in time that the $71.9 million that the governor had tagged for Connect Oregon in the lottery bond will not be available at that level. Right now I'm hearing 30. Which is very, very discouraging. And the privilege tax has been altered to a point where there will be about possibly $10 million a year coming from the privilege tax on an annual basis to Connect. So it is not funded at a level that I am comfortable with. It is something I've, on the record, a number of times said that we need to work harder to figure out how to fund. And in this next cycle, we are going to be in dire straits with Connect, and we need to continue to work on a different source of revenue for this project.
I don't disagree with you, so let me try to understand something. Mm-hmm. Let's assume, for the purpose of discussion, that $40 million is what's available this time.
It would be $30 million for the biennium, so 15 a year plus 10, so about $25 million a year. Is that about right, Cliff? That's about right. No.
If I may, I have no idea is the proper answer for me.
We're estimating what's in the bond bill. We don't know yet.
I can put out my lantern. I found an honest man.
We're hoping
we have no
for
idea
more,
what's
Senator.
In the bond bill. Okay.
Okay.
We're hoping for more.
I have to ask you as a Ways and Means purpose.
Yes. What's in the bonding bill?
So let me go back and try to reframe my question. Assuming that there is a Connect at whatever level, is the Connect available for other projects, or is it completely gobbled up by the enumerated projects in this draft?
There are four projects enumerated in this draft that will, in essence, gobble it for 2 years.
And those are the four that we just discussed, the Willamette Valley, Treasure Valley, Port of Morrow, and Brooks. Mm-hmm. And so I'm just trying to understand this. The time period is the 2 years of the biennium, or is it the 2 years that, say, I'll go back to the Mid-Willamette Valley, the two-year expiration date that it has to get that figured out, or is that Connect money available with longer durability than just the biennium? I'm trying to figure out if these four projects completely subscribe the available Connect. Mm-hmm. How long do they subscribe the available Connect before they're ready to go? Some of them, I think they're in various states of ready to go, but I don't know how long they keep the only Connect capacity.
Senator Boquist.
In theory, if you use the $30 million rumor number, since none of us are in the right Joint Ways and Means Committee, so we have no idea what this number is, $71 million was in the governor's budget. $30 million is the speculative rumor. If you take the $30 million and the additional revenues that we put together, it pays for the four projects that are described in here almost to the dime in a two-year period in the biennium.
How? Because you got 25, 26, 6, and 2 adds up to more than your available resources.
So you have $30 million. In one side, there's actually somewhere the latest forecast number on the privilege tax.
I forgot about that.
Adds that in, and it comes out within a couple $100,000 of doing it. If you get $71 million from the bonding lottery bonding, you would have an additional $40 million for distribution. The next point that's a hinge is as if the good representative now to the far right, that's the only one sitting here, if that project goes away and they don't do something in 2 years, then that funding would be clear, freed up to be utilized.
In the traditional Connect methodology.
Right. We had anticipated and we had heard $71 million. We, of course, do not have $71 million in the committee. We simply don't have the money. And I would once again, in February, we need to go back, and this committee as a whole now needs to go back with its scratch in its head and try and figure out how to expand Connect Oregon. It is a weak link. Absolutely no way about it.
So, if I might.
Yes.
So, I just want to understand again the two-year thing. So, within the 2 years, all that has to have happened during that time is the project be ready to go. Is that correct? designed and everything in place.
Commitment made.
Right. Thank you.
I want to do that a little bit more.
Okay.
I have no idea the Brooks Rail siding extension. I have no idea who that benefits, what railroad it provides.
Senator, that came in a conversation from our colleagues, our constituents, and our stakeholders who are interested in rail congestion on the I-5 corridor, particularly around passenger rail and congestion for freight rail. We have a siding that's not long enough for the trains that are running up and down the track now. So if we can extend that siding a little bit, we can have congestion relief.
Okay, but let me ask this question. Mm-hmm. Rail sidings, unless somebody, a railroad already owns the right-of-way, is going to require right-of-way acquisition, which is, and again, I know nothing about
this
project.
The right-of-way is already there.
This is a project that is already in the ODOT. It's already a project that's been in the works. It just didn't come out of the air. And it has to do with freight capacity as well. It has to do with freight capacity and being able to make Amtrak more predictable.
Okay, and if this is using Connect money, given that this is a rail project, are they going to have to meet the 50% match?
This is going to be an ODOT project.
We were talking about.
So this is just fully funded, no requirement for the 50% match that you're spelling out later in the bill.
That's what I'm talking about. Okay. Intermodal.
Concessions 80.
I'm sorry, Heidi. Where are we?
Sections 80 to 85.
Thank you.
Connect program in general. Just a couple of highlights to change. As you may remember, the Connect Oregon program is expanded to two parts, part one and part two. And in part two, we include class two railroads so that they can also participate in the part two program. And as Senator Johnson mentioned, there is a caveat, and that caveat is that part two won't be funded unless there's at least $75 million in the Connect Oregon fund as of July 1 of an odd-numbered year. Section 85 through 88 have not changed. And then we get into the vehicle privilege tax.
Okay.
Right.
Yes. For the record, Alan Dale, Senior Deputy of Legislative Council. Section 89 on page 187 provides definitions for a privilege and use tax imposed with respect to motor vehicles and an excise tax on bicycles. Section 90 imposes a tax on the privilege of engaging in the business of selling motor vehicles at retail at 0.5% of the retail sales price. Section 90A has to do with the manner in which a vehicle dealer may collect the privilege tax from the purchaser. Section 91 imposes a use tax, and this is a compensatory tax to prevent evasion of the privilege tax by people buying a motor vehicle in another state. So it has to be the same percent, 0.5% of the retail sales price of the motor vehicle. Section 92 imposes an excise tax on bicycles at a flat amount of $15.
Madam Chair. My apologies.
Thank you. No problem.
Representative Smith-Warner.
I apologize. So I just wanted to get some clarification on the language about the privilege tax. I'm trying to find it in the bill because I'm working off the summary. So the summary talks about allowing the vehicle dealer to collect the amount of privilege tax from the purchaser of the motor vehicle.
That's on page 189.
Oh, thank
section
you so
90,
much.
Subsection 3.
And then may I ask then, is there anything that prohibits the dealer from paying that without collecting it from the buyer? Could they eat that cost?
Chairman Kuhn, Representative Smith-Warner, yes. This merely authorizes them to collect. They don't have to. They can collect none, some, or all.
So they could, okay. So
yes.
They could eat it. Great. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
If they want to make a deal.
Okay. Page 192. Section 93 deals with the collection of use tax. Section 94 lists certain sales that will be exempt from the privilege tax. Section 95 deals with refunds. Section 96 directs where the revenue from these three taxes will go. So the, two taxes, the privilege tax and the use tax, and they, we distinguish them. The privilege tax is not subject to Article 9, Section 3A. So for 6 years, $12 million will be transferred annually to the Zero Emission Incentive Fund, which will be discussed later in the bill. And beyond that, money will be transferred to the Connect Oregon Fund. The use tax, by contrast, is subject to Article 9, Section 3A, and so it will be transferred to the State Highway Fund. 97 directs the deposit of the excise tax on bicycles to Connect Oregon Fund. Section 98 through 108 has to do with the administration, collection, and enforcement of the privilege and use tax and the excise tax. And it takes us to page 206. Section 109 is the means for the DMV to enforce the use tax at the time of titling or registration. Section 111 is
Alan.
I'm sorry. Yes.
Thank you. Forgive me for interrupting
Senator Johnson,
you.
Just one moment. Senator Girard, just to orient you, we are going through the bill by sections. We are on page 206 right now. And Mr. Dale is going through the sections that he had purview over. And
or if you're using the section by section,
Smith?
It's okay. Page 19.
Good? If you're looking at the summary, it's on page 19. In the bill, it's page 206. Thank you. Senator Johnson.
There was quite a bit of controversy about this excise tax and perhaps
privilege tax.
And perhaps one of the four of you could explain what's the status now. Is there a reconciliation about this?
Senator Boquist, do you want to elaborate?
Why don't I let Mr. Dale first tell us exactly how it works.
Okay.
And then I'll elaborate on that.
Thank you.
So I get it right and don't use the wrong word. I mistakenly used the wrong word.
So the issue is that Article 9, Section 3A of the Constitution requires that a tax or excise levied on the ownership, operation, or use of motor vehicles be restricted to highway-related uses. And so looking at case law and attorney general opinions, we have structured it as a tax on the privilege of engaging in the business of selling taxable motor vehicles, because that is not a tax or excise levied on the ownership, operation, or use of motor vehicles. So it should be outside the purview of Article 9, Section 3A.
It is.
Senator Johnson.
The amounts. Could you cover the amounts and what's covered?
The amounts?
The amount and coverage.
How much is the privilege?
0.5%.
Oh, 0.5%, yes. It's 0.5% of the retail sales price. So it is computed with respect to the sale, the retail sale of the motor vehicle. But the tax is imposed on the privilege of engaging in the business
and
of selling.
Alan, could you, there's a weight limit as well?
Yes, it's 26,000 or below.
Okay, now may I ask my question?
Certainly.
You were quite quick to correct me on the difference between my nomenclature choice of excise tax versus privilege. What's an excise tax then?
An excise tax is, from the word, it's like a cut of a commodity or a transaction. So it would be an excise tax on a bicycle, for instance.
Like a different word for sales tax.
Yes.
Okay. Can we anticipate that this is going to be litigated to resolve the question?
We will get there.
Pardon me?
We will get there in this bill.
It's coming.
is that a yes?
Yes. Yes.
Thank you.
And how we're going to do
we can. The thing I would say, however, is we have made this a privilege tax because we've looked at the authority, the Oregon authority, to just make it as rock solid a case that this is not subject to Article 9, Section 3A. However, if it were a sales tax, I don't think it would be subject to Article 9, Section 3A either, because subsection 1B, the tax or excise levied on the ownership, operation, or use of a motor vehicle, doesn't use the word sale. So we have just made this as strong a case as possible, but I think you get there anyway.
Get there, you would there get, being litigation.
No, I meant getting out, staying outside of Article 9, Section 3A.
Senator Boquist, did you have...
No, but Casey's going to answer the rest of her questions.
Okay.
Please continue, Mr.
Where
Dale.
Was I?
And then I'll pick up the pieces.
Okay, so on page 206, Section 111 is a moratorium on local governments imposing a privilege or use tax on motor vehicles.
So that's, excuse me, so that moratorium here only applies to the use tax or the...
The privilege.
Privilege.
Well, no, it's broader than that.
Well, that's what I meant.
It is a, it applies to a privilege tax on the engaging in the business of selling taxable right. motor vehicles or any other privilege, excise, sales, or use tax on taxable motor vehicles.
So I'm trying to understand what that means then, because the sales tax. So what we've already talked about what we're going to do. So what other additional ones is this preventing local jurisdictions from doing?
A straight up sales tax, for instance.
Okay.
Okay, section 112. Here we are.
Alan, just a moment. Just for the audience and the people who may be watching this, the reason people are getting up and leaving and coming back is we have a couple of other committees and a floor session that is occurring. So people are stepping out to go vote on other things and then they're coming back. I just don't want you to think people are willy-nilly just wandering away. But there's an awful lot going on. So when you see people doing that, that's what's occurring. Please continue.
Sure. Section 112 expresses the intent of the Legislative Assembly that the privilege tax is not subject to the provisions of Article 9, Section 3A, and then confers original jurisdiction on the Supreme Court to determine whether that's the case or not. The case would have to be filed within 30 days after the effective date of this of the Act. And the original jurisdiction is limited to that question. If the Supreme Court determines that the privilege tax is subject to Article 9, Section 3A, then the privilege tax will be repealed. And we would have to repeal the use tax also, because they you can't have a use tax without a tax that it compensates for under the Dormant Commerce Clause.
Representative Lively.
I guess yes. I didn't understand what you just said. Oh, so if it's if the court finds it...
I'm sorry, if the court finds that the privilege tax is subject to Article 9, Section 3A, then the privilege tax is repealed.
Okay.
And in addition, we have to repeal the use tax, because you can't have a use tax standing by itself.
Mr. Dale, there may be some confusion about the difference between the privilege tax and the use tax.
Yeah, okay.
Would you mind explaining that,
sure.
please?
So a use tax is it's the compensatory tax doctrine. So you impose a tax on the privilege of engaging in business of selling taxable motor vehicles. If you don't have a use tax, this would encourage people to go out of state.
Okay.
Oregon residents go out of state and then bring them back into Oregon to use. So the use tax is imposed on the use of an automobile bought outside of the state.
So just to make it simple, if you go to Washington and buy a car and you're an Oregonian, the Washington dealer registers and licenses your car, titles it in Oregon, they will collect
the
that fee and it will come back to Oregon.
Right.
That's
right.
What that means.
Okay.
And so we have to repeal that, because you can't have it without a tax that it's compensating for. Sections 115 and 16 are conforming amendments. 117. 118 is the Origo rate increases. 118C provides that an electric vehicle in the Origo program is not subject to the additional registration fee discussed below. And I think that's... Pardon? that, sorry. Section 119 is a feasibility study of doing, right, the highway cost allocation study with respect to highway restricted taxes that are imposed only within a local jurisdiction.
Sections 120 and 120A create the traffic congestion relief program and provide for value pricing on certain highways, primarily in the Portland area, and then deposit that money into the new congestion relief fund for the purposes of the program. Sections 121 and 122 are the task force on mega transportation projects. The only difference here is that we've clarified that we're talking about projects that are $360 million or more. Then we get into transit funding. 122A through 122M provide a revenue on wages to provide for monies for transit. The major difference here is that the applicability date is July 1, 2018, so it won't start collecting until July 1, 2018. And then we also made some clarifications in sections 122N to the end of the series, which is 122R, specifically that 90% of the revenues raised would go to qualified entities, which are defined in the bill, after they provide to the commission a public transportation improvement plan describing what they're going to do and if they've received money, what they have done to meet certain requirements. 5% will be available for competitive grants for all of the public transportation service providers, and 4% in grants specifically to provide connections between communities, and 1% for ODOT to establish a statewide public transportation technical resource center.
So all entities that would receive, thank you, receive money under the 90% have to submit the report that was you just spoke of.
So if you're a qualified entity, you have to give to the Oregon Transportation Commission a plan. And this plan must describe how you're going to meet the requirements of the bill. And if you receive money, the plan must describe what you've done in the past.
Senator Mike.
To be real clear, because I know people have questions, that everybody who gets money has to submit a plan.
That's what
there is not an entitlement. There is an allocation that they can apply for, and they have to meet the – they have to – satisfy the OTC that they meet the requirements of law.
And everybody that receives money has to submit a plan. I would reverse that. They have to submit a plan to get the money.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. And then after they get the money, they have to submit another plan. They have to continue to
meet the standard that the bill requires.
To the left.
Yes. Senator Monroe.
Yes. Is the number still approximately $100 million a year that this will raise?
I believe it's a little bit above that, 107. Mr. Malik, 105. Okay. A little bit over 100, sir. That's Senator right. Johnson.
I want to go back to these plans, and this is an issue I've had since the onset of this discussion. And that is, there are transit agencies and transit agencies. There are the great big ones that dominate metropolitan areas, and then there are lots of little ones that are run in a variety of different schemes. Some of them have taxing districts. Some of them rely on the kindness of strangers. Some of them are well-run. Some of them have books that are not auditable. Some of them have financial displays that are embedded in county budgets. I'm trying to figure out how we bring some degree of discipline and oversight to these districts that are not professionally run. And I have learned over the time discussing transit that that harm to one is harm to all. So they will quickly run out of this room saying, Johnson hates transit. I don't. But I would like some degree of assurance that there will be responsible fiscal oversight over some of these transit districts that are building buildings with no efficacy, are buying buses that they drive the wheels off of and don't take care of, have the wrong vehicles for the wrong purpose. Where's the accountability for transit here?
Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator, I agree with you in what we're trying to do. And the reason we went to the plans is there are 140-some different companies or organizations, as you said, particularly in the rural areas. The problem is not with the big ones, different problems or different concerns, I should say, with that. What we're trying to do through the Transportation Commission is, and one of the reasons there's 1% is for the money there, is to get them to collapse and put a logical network of transit agencies across the state with the inner city connections, so someone in a wheelchair in Newport can get to the bus station, get on an inner city transit to Corvallis, and get on a local bus there to get to their doctor. I mean, that's the vision that we're trying to do.
I hope that includes looking at ODOT being in the bus business. And no disrespect, Mr. Garrett, but it came as a big surprise to me that you suddenly were running a bus right through three of my transit districts. I didn't know that that was happening. And I'm trying to, I agree with you that there's got to be some logic to this.
Yes.
And some of these little agencies are so turfed up that the idea of even contemplating merging or collapsing one into the other is an anathema. I don't know whether or not ODOT's transit division is sufficiently robust to deal with $100 million now floating through with all of these plans that have to be reviewed. And I'm pleading for some kind of enforcement. It's not good enough to write a plan that says we're going to provide bus service to the elderly, the disabled, and folks that don't have a car. I want to know, where's the oversight? Where's the enforcement? Where's the choking off of the money if it becomes formulaic and there's failure to perform?
Senator Meyer.
Indeed, the three major criteria that are there is extending reach to unserved areas, increasing frequency, and providing services to low-income people or subsidies so that they can ride the bus. As I said, you have to submit an application, a plan saying how you're going to do that to the OTC, and then annually, I think it was annually or biennially, I forget how we ended in the bill, they have to report in order to continue to receive money into the future.
Well, it still begs the question, and maybe you'll put this on the we'll get back to in February list, and that is ODOT organized in a way that can handle this exponential increase in their responsibilities and oversight and direction? Because some of these groups are not going to come to collaboration naturally.
Some of these groups won't get money.
Understood.
Unless they do.
Please continue.
123 and 124, the Safe Routes to Schools program. What's important to know about the date changes from the Dash 3 amendments is that we've decreased the amount of match that's required for certain populations, and those are schools in a city of a population of 5,000 or fewer. If the project reduces hazards within a safety corridor as defined by the commission, or if it's a Title I school. It also increases the scope from a quarter mile to 1 mile within the schools.
And it increases the amount at,
yes,
over time as
previously
well.
Previously in the Dash 3 amendments, the projects were supposed to be constricted to a quarter mile of a K-8 or K-12 school, and now we've expanded that to 1 mile.
But what I was referring to is it's $10 million a year starting out, and then it increases to $15 million, I believe, at year 4, year 5.
Chairman Kuhn, yes, you're correct. That happens in 71A and 71B.
Thank you. Representative Lively.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. So I'm trying to understand, so when we talked about the Safe Routes to School, one of the things we talked about besides this lower match was that given the limited amount of funds we have regardless, is that those the other grants be that there be some priority given to Title I schools in those. And I don't, does that say that in here?
Yes.
Can you show me where that says it in here? Sorry, I'm missing it.
Section 123?
Yeah.
After Title I, the school
3, right. C, line 3, page 239.
Okay, thanks.
The school site qualifies for assistance under Chapter Title I. Chapter 1 of Title I of the Federal Elementary and Secondary Education Act of 1965.
But, so, sorry.
No, fine.
So, but it, A says the school located in a city of population of 5,000 or fewer, then B, the hazards. So C, I'm just trying to understand. So C, where it says Chapter Title I, that's any projects. It's not just the projects in the smaller communities. It's in any community that applies.
There's different criteria. Either a community under 5,000
or they're in a safety corridor,
or thank you.
They are a Title I school.
Thank you.
Yep.
I got it.
Madam Chair.
Senator Johnson.
Who's going to be air traffic control for sequencing of these improvements? What I'm trying to figure out is that if a community races in and applies for safe routes to school, builds it, and then finds out that they're on the STIP, if there's any money left, is going to get a street improvement, and we tear up the safe routes to school improvements and do something else.
I'll look at Senator Byers. Was that? Yeah.
It's ODOT. They already have the safe routes to schools program. If they're getting other money, they're getting that through ODOT as well. That's your control.
Okay.
And you're the oversight of this committee. You can have my seat.
Nothing enrages folks more than to build a project and then tear it up to do another project.
Absolutely.
So. Sections 125 to 131 relate to the roadside rest areas. There's one technical change. The statute says that ODOT is supposed to maintain ownership of its rest areas. ODOT doesn't actually own government camp, so that's what we have to say, except government camp. They're going to maintain ownership of it. TIC does the maintenance. Travel Information Council. Section 132 is a technical correction to the City of Damascus that remained unchanged from the -3 amendments. Section 133 remains unchanged as well, overpass screenings and eliminating the number of required overpass screenings.
Senator Johnson.
I want to flag this for the now growing February list. That government camp rest area, I don't know if there's a private contractor who has anything to do with that parking lot. If memory serves me, there is. And I just want to make sure that when we sort out Forest Service, private contractor, and ODOT, and now the Travel Information Council, that the private contractor gets an opportunity to have some say in this. I just don't think it's fair to mow over a private entrepreneur. And I'm just asking the chair to put that on the February list. It's the rest areas. I'm on the summary of the bill, page 25 at the top. It's Ms. Elliott pointed out that ODOT does not own government camp.
Right, I'm looking for that. Which section?
And I don't see exactly which section that is.
Heidi, what section is that?
125.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Section 134, the orphan highways. We specify that the portion of Boulevard from I-205 to 174th will be transferred to the City of Portland. However, unlike the other transfers, ODOT, Department of Transportation, will do the upgrades first and then transfer. The rest of the transfers, the allocation will happen after the transfer occurs.
So just
we also add Pioneer Parkway in Springfield and the Springfield Crossway Highway.
Representative Lively.
So if I have this, so in the case of Powell, the improvements will be completed before the transfer occurs. In the case of all the other jurisdictional transfers, the transfer will occur, but the money will still be available to do the improvements. Is that what you said?
So for Powell, the improvements will happen first,
right,
and then ODOT will transfer in phases as it improves.
Okay.
For the rest of the transfer will happen first, and then who's ever receiving, whether it's the state or the city or a county, will receive their allocation that's described in Section 71D.
So I'm still confused what that means. I'm trying to understand who's paying for the improvements to the
Senator
highway.
Senator Byer.
Try that one. In each case, there will be a transfer agreement executed before anything happens.
Okay. I'm fine with that.
In most of them, the receiving entity will take title to the property, and with that will come a check,
okay,
and they will be responsible for doing the improvements that have been agreed to. In the case of Powell, for other reasons,
the
folks wanted to do it a different way.
Okay. Thank you.
In three phases.
Senator Johnson.
Okay. I just want to make sure that there had been... Originally, the idea was that there were going to be these jurisdictional transfers. Suddenly, we're going to build Powell out completely, and it's going to get handed over only after it's fixed. The others are not treated as well or similarly. I just want to flag my exception to that.
That's not quite true, because Powell will be finished in three sections, and one section could be completed and then turned over to the other jurisdiction, then the second, then the third. So it isn't the whole thing all at once.
The City of Portland money.
Senator Byer.
Okay, well, so fine. Senator Byer may have answered my question offline. Does money accompany each one of these transfers now?
Except for yours.
I think he said that, didn't he?
Yeah, that's what I'm wondering. Did my little pittance get lost on the way to the draft?
I don't remember.
Actually, it's going to be a lot more expensive, and the director has acknowledged that against his wishes, he's going to accept a new highway.
I know that, but as a mitigation acknowledgement to the director's forbearance to take this, there was a pittance compared to the rest of this. It appears that my pittance got lost on the way to the draft. True or false?
Senator, I'm going to stand at ease for a second. All right, where were we?
134.
Section 135.
135 to 138. Halting and plowing. We no longer require local governments to come and have a specific halting and plowing requirement. We are going to direct the OTC to come up with a winter maintenance strategy that considers the use of salt while also considering environmental concerns. Section 139 and that provides the operative dates for all the highway user fees. Section 140 is the repeal section for certain sections that are being repealed. Section 141 abolishes the Urban Trail Fund and transfers that money to Connect Oregon. I believe it's about $6,000 in that fund that's being transferred to Connect. Sections 142 to 146 are conflict amendments in the event that certain other bills that are mentioned in those conflict amendments pass. 2017 will trump and be the prevailing bill. But just in case those bills pass, we don't know yet, but we have to provide for that contingency. Section 147.
Severability clause.
And then finally, we get to hear from Maureen.
Okay. Thank you for your patience, Maureen.
Co-chair, very grateful. Kuhn and Beyer and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Maureen McGee. I'm a deputy in the Office of Legislative Counsel, and I'm going to bring this home to this afternoon. I will be going through first sections 148 through 157. I'll be going through those in detail. These are the provisions that relate to the zero emission and electric vehicle rebate programs. Section 148 is a definitional section. Section 149 requires the Department of Environmental Quality to establish a program for rebates for the purchase of new light-duty zero-emission and plug-in hybrid vehicles. This program can be administered by a third-party administrator. Section 150 separately requires DEQ to establish a Charge Ahead Oregon program for providing cash rebates for new and used light-duty zero-emission vehicles to low- and moderate-income households.
Excuse me, Maureen, just one second.
Sorry.
Representative Lively
Maureen,
has a question.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. So I just want to clarify in Section 149. So this is for purchase or lease of a vehicle. They can get a rebate.
Co-Chair McEwen, Representative Lively, yes, that is correct. It's for purchase or lease.
And in the case of the lease has to be at least 24 months.
Yes.
But they get the same rebate as if they bought the car.
Yes.
Thank you.
So Section 150, Section 150 separately requires the department to establish the Charge Ahead Oregon program. And as I was saying, this is a cash rebate program as well for both new and used light-duty zero-emission vehicles for low- and moderate-income households that agree to retire or scrap older vehicles, somewhat akin to a Cash for Clunkers program. And this program may also be administered by a third party, and people that qualify for rebates under both programs can combine the rebates. Section 151 sets forth auditing and reporting requirements.
Madam Chair.
Yes, ma'am.
What's the Senator source Johnson. Of the money for the rebates, the Cash for Clunkers?
Madam Chair, Senator Johnson, the source of the money for both programs is provided for later on in this section. I'll get to it, but it is the privilege tax. A portion of the revenues from the privilege tax that Alan discussed are deposited in a zero emission incentive fund that is in Section 152 of the bill. And then the money goes to
this. So you use the expression cash for clunkers.
I don't think that's exactly what you meant. Rep. McEwen, Senator Johnson, I appreciate that. I said somewhat akin to. It's similar in that it is a program for providing cash rebates for the purchase of newer used light-duty zero-emission vehicles. As part of the requirements to qualify for that program, the qualifying the recipient has to show that they are going to scrap or render inoperable a high-emission passenger motor vehicle that on the date of the rebate application is registered as operable and has been continuously registered for the last 2 years.
What does that mean? I'm going to take my old Buick. He used the brand Buick to the junkyard. I mean, what does that mean?
It means scrap or otherwise render inoperable. So, to scrap would be to take to the junkyard. A high emission passenger motor vehicle is defined as a vehicle that's designed primarily for the transportation of persons and is powered by an internal combustion engine that's 20 years old or older.
But
Senator Winters.
Follow up. But if I've got a vehicle, an old vehicle, that at the moment is inoperable, then it would qualify?
No.
I mean, how inoperable does it have to be?
It has
to be operable. Can you go over that definition again, kind of in layman's terms, please?
So, Co-Chair McEwen, Senator Winters, it says that it has to be registered as operable and has to have been continuously registered for the last 2 years.
It really makes no sense. Why would you do that? Why would you do that?
It's not registered and sitting in your back 40. It doesn't count.
But I've got one right now. See, I mean, that's my point. That doesn't get me there.
Senator Winters, did you have...
No, because I can think of a lot of scenarios that could fit that definition, and I'm trying to figure out what really inoperable. Are we really ready for the junkyard?
I think the intent is that it be operable. It was operable.
It was operable
for the previous 2 years.
Yes.
Correct.
Is it registered?
I mean, registered and operable for the previous two years. So you can't go pick up a dead car and go turn it in. It has to have been operable for the previous 2 years, the way I understand it. Does that sound correct, Maureen?
Brett McEwen, yes, I would say that is correct. And I would also say that if you look on page 266 of the bill, this is subsection 18 of section 150. It does state that the Environmental Quality Commission may adopt any rules necessary to carry out the provisions of the section to the extent that would need additional clarity.
Yeah, it is.
There would be that opportunity. Moving on, section 151 sets forth auditing and reporting requirements for both rebate programs. Section 152 establishes the Zero Emission Incentive Fund. The rebates under both rebate programs are paid from this fund, and as I mentioned earlier, the fund is populated with monies received through the privilege tax on the new motor vehicle sales.
Can I ask a question?
Senator Winters,
are these rebates available only for Oregonian registered vehicles and that nobody can come in from outstate or other states in order to take advantage of this program?
I'm assuming that is the intent. Is that the way
I want it on the record, Maureen? That is the intent.
Chair McEwen, Senator Winters, yes, I'm looking for the exact language here. So, and this language appears in both rebate programs, but looking just to the main rebate program, section 149, subsection 7B, to be eligible, the person must provide proof of an intent to use the qualifying vehicle primarily on the public highways of the state, which may be satisfied by providing proof of registration of the qualifying vehicle in Oregon.
Senator Winters.
Do they have to be a resident?
There is not a specific residency requirement.
So, hypothetically, I could come in, register, and not be a resident, and drive from here to California on the highway and get a rebate.
Well,
Mr. Dale?
Yeah, Alan Dale again. Chair McEwen, Senator Winters. The intent is that the vehicle be used primarily on the highways of the state. So if you drive through the state once,
or twice.
If the intent would be, say, for instance, someone who lives in Vancouver and works in Salem, and uses the car only to get to work, that person is essentially driving on the, percentage-wise, driving the car as much on the highways of Oregon as a person who lives in Portland and commutes to Salem.
Mr. Dale, so, on page 264, it's 8B.
Yeah.
Would that help define this? I'll be back.
So, Chairman Kuhn, what you're pointing to is specifically in the Charge Ahead rebate program. So this is the program for the low income. And that specifies that as additional criteria for getting that type of rebate, the person must be a member of a low income or moderate income household and also reside in an area of the state that has elevated concentrations of air contaminants commonly attributable to motor vehicle emissions. Such as?
I can't say, Chair McKeon, Senator Winters. Mm-hmm. Part of the concern is. Right.
Yes.
Part of
yes.
the concern is a constitutional problem of treating in state and out of state residents differently with respect to this benefit. And so.
I guess, and I'm concerned also if we open up Pandora's box, and that's why I'm seeing how tight it is that we don't have individuals coming in and to avail themselves of the rebate.
Mm-hmm. Rob McKeon, Senator Winters, it does provide that the way that you it specifically provides that way that you. Prove qualification is a way that you can prove qualification is through proof of registration in the state of Oregon, and you have to be a resident of the state in order to register. So,
questions?
I believe. I was on sections 153 through 155 of the amendment where we double or amend again the general rebate program that's set forth in section 149. And these double amendments expand the rebate program after its first full year of implementation to also allow rebates to be provided for neighborhood electric vehicles and zero emission motorcycles. Under Section 156, the rebates may be issued for motor vehicle purchases and leases that occur on and after the effective date of the Act. Under Section 157, both of the rebate programs sunset on January 2, 2024. Sections 158 through 174 of the amendment are the provisions addressing the low-carbon fuel standards.
So before we leave...
Representative Lyman.
So I would like somebody, I would just like to understand a little bit more about the rebates available for leasing versus purchasing. It appears to me the person, so they only get the rebate once. So if they lease it, get a new car every 2 years. I'm just trying to understand the advantage anybody would have to purchase it versus to lease it. Isn't it more advantageous from a rebate standpoint, given the cost? I guess I'm just missing why we would give them that much rebate to lease versus to purchase the car. I mean, a person that doesn't lease cars, I guess maybe I don't understand it.
Maybe we should have some of the dealers in who do.
And honestly, I wish I had an answer. I don't, but it's something we're going to have to clarify, obviously.
I would appreciate that.
Maureen, is there another way to clarify that would help? Because that wasn't an area that I worked in when we were putting this together, so...
Rob McKeon, Lively, I think that the most that I can say is that it is drafted such that the rebates are available. The rebates under the Section 149 general rebate program are for the purchase or lease, and the amounts of the rebates are set out by the type of vehicle. Mm-hmm. So they don't distinguish between whether it's a purchase or lease, but they are set out by the type of vehicle. So for a light-duty zero-emission vehicle, you can receive a rebate that is up to $2,500, but not less than $1,500. I can also say that it is set up so that the department prescribes the amount of the qualifying rebate annually. And so that's why there are the ranges there, that the department can prescribe the rebate amount annually as long as it fits within that range.
Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think the question is answered on page 261, sub 9.
So they're both required at the 24-month fee solid for?
The language says, shall notify the administrator of the program the recipient's intent to sell the vehicle or terminate the lease and shall reimburse the administrator for the entire rebate amount in 24 months.
Thank you. Nice to have a lawyer on the panel.
Yeah. If they're going to terminate within 2 years, they got to give it all back.
I understand that. But so is there a requirement that we have to also provide it to the lease that we provide for their, or that's just something we chose to do? The rebate. Is the requirement that if we do the rebate, it has to be both on leased vehicles and purchased vehicles, that they have to both be, or could we choose just to provide a rebate on purchased vehicles?
Senator Beyer, do you recall having a, I don't remember a conversation about this.
I was out. I didn't know what.
Yeah. Oh, we're talking about the difference between just providing the rebate on purchased vehicles as opposed to leased and purchased vehicles.
My understanding, I don't know, the discussion, I wasn't involved in that discussion directly, but the main program was for purchase of new vehicles. The section that we've been discussing was the intent was to allow people of lower income to purchase leased vehicles. I think that's the idea. Those are former leased vehicles. The idea being some of the ones, the leases and some of those are coming off of leases and would be available to them.
Am
I missing the question?
Does that clarify or is that not correct?
So, Matt McKeon, members of the committee, just to reiterate, the rebate program that is provided for in Section 149 of the bill allows for the rebates to be provided for the purchase or lease of new vehicles. The rebate program that is provided for in Section 150 of the bill allows for the rebates to be issued to low and moderate income households for the purchase of new or used light duty zero emission vehicles.
I think we're kind of struggling with the, and I think it was a good question that was asked by Representative Lively of new we get, leased we don't. And why they were both put in the same category. Maybe I missed something, but can I ask a question? How many of the industry that's affected by this did you have conversation with on this particular subject?
Brett McEwen, Senator Winters, that is not a question that I'm at liberty to answer on the record.
Oh, really? That tells me a lot.
Brett McEwen, Senator Winters.
I think we're going to stand at ease for just 1 minute, see if we can get some clarification. All right, we're back in session. Thank you. This is a piece of the bill that came late, and I think this is something we're going to need to work on a bit in February. It is my understanding that in the conversations with the car dealers, that this was something that they were comfortable with doing. This is the way it is in the bill right now. If the whole idea is to incentivize the purchase of electric vehicles, and this has a six-year sunset on it, that this will get us further down the road, and that is why it is done this way. But this obviously is going to need some work. Representative Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Madam Co-Chair. I would just note that on page 260, the department is given the power to set annually the amount of the rebate. And there is a floor on the larger capacity cars of $1,500 and a floor of $750 on the lighter capacity. But what I'm suggesting is in between now and February, I am going to hazard a guess that the department is going to be careful in how it utilizes its authority to write rules when it comes to issuing these rebates for these purposes. And if we're unhappy with whatever rules they come up with, assuming they have them by then, we can address them in February.
I appreciate that, Representative.
Further questions? Moving along, Maureen.
Moving along. Sections 158 through 174 of the amendment are provisions addressing the low carbon fuel standards. Section 158 adds all the new provisions in this series to the air quality laws. Section 159 is a definitional section. Section 160 amends the existing low carbon fuels standard statute to specify in statute that the Department of Environmental Quality shall adopt a clean fuels program to facilitate compliance with the standards, and it makes some other conforming changes. And I'll just note here to keep in mind that the department does currently facilitate compliance with the low carbon fuel standards through a clean fuels program that it has developed and adopted by rules. So this memorializes that in statute. Section 161 sets forth standards for biodiesel to be considered a low-carbon fuel under the low-carbon fuel standards. Section 162 requires certain minimum design elements for the clean fuels program. It also requires the department to monthly calculate the volume-weighted average price of credits, which are...
Senator Johnson.
Ask Representative Benz this. Under the definition of biodiesel as a low carbon, I mean, as a part of the low carbon fuels package, was consideration given to any other fuel sources, fuel stocks?
In what regard?
Oh, I don't even know if this would qualify, but any discussion about ethanol, any discussion about any other?
Question is, did we, in adopting a required standard for diesel, consider required standards for any other quality of fuel?
Thank you. I was in the back of the room, and I didn't hear the whole conversation. I apologize.
No, but that we have in this just concern, we had a standard concerning diesel because of Daimler's trucking's concern about the quality of the fuel and warranty issues having to do with diesel. We did not have, beyond that, we did not discuss the issue of fuel quality.
Thank you. And I think that Daimler's concerns about the biodiesel are completely fine. I just didn't know what the broader discussion was.
That was the reason.
So Section 162, as I stated, requires a certain minimum design elements. It also requires the department to monthly calculate the volume-weighted average price of credits. Credits are a compliance tool in the Clean Fuels Program. It requires the department to calculate the average annual cost or cost savings of the standards per gallon of gas or diesel and the total annual greenhouse gas emissions reductions attributable to the standards and to make that information available on the department's website. Section 163 requires the Office of Economic Analysis at DAS to annually coordinate with Department of Environmental Quality to develop a fuel supply forecast looking forward into the next compliance period for the Clean Fuels Program. Section 164 requires DEQ to order a forecast deferral at least 30 days prior to the beginning of the calendar year, beginning of the compliance period, if the fuel supply forecast projects that the amount of credits available is less than 100% of those needed to comply, and sets out some minimum content of the order for that. Section 165 is the emergency deferral provision. It requires the department to issue an emergency deferral within 15 days of when the department determines there's a known shortage of fuel or clean fuel is required to meet the low carbon fuel standard, and sets out the steps for issuing that deferral. Section 166 requires the department to hold credit clearance markets as a means for facilitating compliance with the low carbon fuel standards, and it sets forth certain requirements for the administration of the credit clearance markets, including setting $200 as a maximum price for credits in the market for 2018 and allowing that to be adjusted for inflation starting in 2019. Section 167 includes a general rulemaking authorization for the department regarding low carbon fuel standards and some provisions for exemptions from applicability of this series of laws. Section 168 and 169 double amend the emergency deferral provisions to include a new provision that becomes operative a year delayed, so January 1, 2019. This is specific to addressing price swings and market manipulation within the Clean Fuels Program. Section 170 requires the department to conduct a review of the Clean Fuels Program no later than February 1st, 2022, and sets forth the requirements for that review. Sections 171 and 172 authorize gas station owners and operators to disclose to customers the average cost per gallon of gas and diesel of the low-carbon fuel standards over the previous calendar year, as calculated by the department under Section 162. It requires that if an owner-operator decides to disclose those costs, it must also disclose the amount of total greenhouse gas emission reductions attributable to the low-carbon fuel standards during that year.
Okay. Senator Johnson.
How are those folks supposed to calculate that amount and to make sure that it's uniform across geographic areas?
Chair McEwen, Senator Johnson, that amount is actually determined annually by the Department of Environmental Quality.
Okay.
And so what the gas station owners and operators would be disclosing is information that has already been calculated and put together by the department.
And perhaps I should direct this to Representative Benz. The method of disclosure is posted on the pumps, printed on the receipt, stamped on somebody's forehead.
Out. The last one. All of those.
All of those.
I'm not sure. It's up to the owner of the service station how they choose to disclose.
And I will just add to that, there are three different methods that are specified in the statute from which they can choose for that disclosure, and that's on page 294 of the bill. Those three different methods are posting on the pump, printing on the receipt, or otherwise displaying the disclosures near the point of payment or another location that's visible to customers. Sections 173 and 174 provide that these changes to the low-carbon fuel standards become operative on January 1st, 2018. They authorize DEQ to begin advanced rulemaking and exempt that rulemaking from applicability of certain review requirements set forth in the existing low-carbon fuel standards statute. And then finally, Section 175 is a purely technical provision about captions in the bill, and Section 176 provides that this Dash 10 amendment to House Bill 2017 takes effect on the 91st day after sine die.
And that concludes your presentation.
And that concludes my presentation. Thank you.
I think what I would like to do is, while we have all our professional staff here, we have Mr. Malik, we have ODOT. Are there any further questions for the professional staff while we have them with us? Okay. Patrick just went down to check to see if the fiscal is ready. We're hoping it will be ready shortly.
Does that mean we can? I have a question that is not really the professional staff. Would this be an appropriate time to ask it?
Certainly.
Okay, thank you. The multimodal designated in here is, in all due respect to my colleague from Albany, that the transload facility in here is designated Albany. I'm just trying to understand, there was conversations earlier about somewhere in the valley, which could be someplace different than Albany. Mm-hmm. And I'm just trying to understand what happened to those conversations and or if this is the site, how that decision was made.
Senator Beyer.
It still is designated as somewhere in the valley. Okay. And I guess it was appropriate to say who submits a proposal that's acceptable first.
Okay, it's on, Andy.
I think it's probably fair to say that from what I understand, I don't know this, Representative Olson may know more, when we've talked about it in the past, the reason those two projects are important and of statewide significance, and we've had the discussion about the Eastern Oregon one, mm-hmm. makes a lot of sense to get that crop there rather than having it drive 300 miles north first. We've talked for many years since I've been in the legislature about the biggest thing we can do to reduce congestion on I-5, particularly in the metro area, is to get the cans off of the trucks and onto trains sooner, which is why the legislature did a study, or in the last, what was it, 2 years ago, we authorized that to try to do that. It's still an unknown whether anybody will actually do that. That's why the 2 years are in there. The thought process behind that was we put that on the table, the intent of the legislature, and we see if somebody puts the deal together. Probably most of the activity to date has been in the central Linn County area, which actually makes a lot of sense because you've got two distribution centers there, which bring a lot of traffic, a lot of containers in, and the majority of the straw farmers are in that central area, so it's a central location. It could be, as Representative, as you know, in the past, there have been piggyback facilities in the Eugene Junction City area, so it's possible somebody could come in with a logical project there. But it's really going to be driven by somebody who has a deal together. And you see Representative Smith, who is the expert on these things.
Well, I actually have a technical question on this. As I read the legislation under Section 71F, it says the department shall distribute the following amounts for the projects listed below. And it lists them out. It's pretty obvious who the recipient will be for the Port of Morrow East Beach Industrial Park. How do you know who the recipient is for Mid-Willamette Valley?
Right.
Again, that would be an application.
To who?
And the reason we say whoever applies.
To who?
OTC.
Who would decide that?
So is the commission going to put an RFP out and say we've got a bucket load of money, who's going to put a project together?
I'm not really sure how they would do that.
Ask council.
You may want to define that a little closer. You're gonna have every entity in the world trying to fight for these dollars.
Well, if we do, that would be great.
That would be great.
But I don't think that's likely.
No, what will end up happening, Mr. Chair, is you're going to have a dividing up of the cash in what could have been a project of regional significance. Well, if history repeats itself, you're going to have seven small little projects everywhere that doesn't have that significance.
We're looking for one.
No, we're looking for
one. Go ahead, Senator. You've been in the middle of this.
Okay, well, let me just share. Yeah. I don't see where it tightly says that.
Senator Winters.
I just want to add, your Mid-Valley legislators are very, very interested and supportive. You know, both, I know Senator Byers and myself and others back in when I was on the Vision work group, we talked about the need here. And then, fortunately, there was the dollars for the study that took place. And so we'd be very happy if we have more than one entity who would like to bid, quite honestly. And I know that my good representative, Olson, in his area is also interested, and he's done some really good groundwork. So the Valley folks are here, and we will keep close eye and close tabs on what's going on. Representative Smith, thank you.
Yeah, it's not my region. I just be careful.
No, yes, I'm co-chair. I just want to be clear that it was my intent throughout that this be the Albany project, and Mid-Valley was used because at the time we wrote that phrase a month or so ago, we did not enjoy some of the data that since has been supplied by the Albany location. So I just want the record clear. As far as I'm concerned, it's Albany. Unless they trip and stumble and can't get their act together, then at that point it would be somebody else in the Mid-Valley. But I want the record clear, my intent is that meant Albany.
Madam Chair, question again.
Yes.
Question to Council. Is not the subsection goes before the allocation of funds actually from the Department of Transportation and OTC? Is that not correct?
Chair McKeown, Chair Beyer, Senator Boquist, I received a call from LFO that really the only person, the entity with authority to make the allocation is the department. So in this case, it is the department who has
I'm somewhat troubled by this last exchange that, you know, City A doesn't get it together, so then City B comes in and gives it a shot. City C comes in and gives it a shot. How long does this bounce around? I mean, I can recall that OBDD did a feasibility, Oregon Business Development Department did a feasibility study, and that study was subject to some criticism when it came out that it was, you know, portrayed a little bias or there this, that, and the other thing that was not acceptable to some folks about it. But I'm wondering how this works and how long the opportunity stays open. And when does this become, I think I'm paraphrasing Representative Smith, when does this become such a chase for money that we lose track of the efficacy of the program and we just try to find some peg that fits in some hole to spend $26 million bucks?
Representative Smith.
No, I thank you, Madam Chair. Following Representative Ben's comments, I feel much more comfortable knowing that there's a legislative intent attached with what Mid-Willamette Valley means. Thank you.
Senator Boquist.
Again, question back of council. If I recall correctly, there's a 24-month, is there a 24-month timeline on this particular project? Is that not correct in the statute?
Yes.
Chairman Kieran, Chair Beyer, Senator Boquist, yes, you're correct. And it spells out the requirements that they have to produce a plan and present that plan before they can even receive the money.
To the department.
Yes.
Sorry.
And that's spelled out in Section 71 after the ballot.
So any further questions? Okay. We are in a holding pattern for the moment. We should have our legislative fiscal staff is obviously well burdened right now, and we hope to have the fiscal documents from them within the next 10 minutes or so, maybe 15 minutes. So we have a choice of either moving the bill without or waiting a few minutes until we have the fiscal. I think it would be prudent to wait until we have those documents in hand. So on that note, we're going to stand at ease for a few minutes.
Let's reconvene and ask, let Betsy have a
question. I don't remember.
Once again, good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for your patience. We hear the fiscal is on its way down. I believe we had one more question that Senator Johnson wanted to raise before we move the bill.
Thank you. Colleagues, I would direct your attention to page 154 of the main bill and page 12 of the summary. I want to go back and talk about these four Connect projects that seem to me to be a little bit vague right now. Let me establish my bona fides by saying I am a huge supporter of Connect. I have sat through the Kabuki Theater of all of the Connects from my act all the way through final selection. I'd say I know a lot about the program. But my understanding of these four projects that are going to gobble up the available Connect for the next biennium remains a little bit vague. I understand that for the Mid-Willamette, there's a two-year period. But I want to know what order these are going to come in and what is the showing of readiness. And I will disclose a bias right out of the box. I've been down to Treasure Valley. I have seen that facility. I have talked to the folks down there. I believe that, and I would defer to people that live there, that that project is probably the ripest of the projects. But I want to know, how will the selection be made for which of these comes out of the chute? How will the money be sold? How will the money be distributed? I just don't understand how these four projects are going to go. And if
Senator Johnson, I think I'll refer to Representative Bentz, who is a bit of an expert on these projects, so I'm going to turn to him for an answer.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair, and thank you, Senator, for the question. And, of course, I admit a bias toward the Treasure Valley Intermodal Facility, since I've been working on that facility for the better part of 10 to 15 years, and more recently and more focused in a more focused way the last couple of years. The community is hugely behind the facility and believes it would be transformational. The work is already started at BizOrg in acquiring the land or different taking options on different parcels for its location. And there are there's a group of folks in the community formed up to assist merely awaiting the passage of this bill. I would hope that the Treasure Valley facility would be first out of the chute, and I can guarantee you that that community, the three communities, will be doing everything in their power to exceed the two-year standard set forth in the bill or the January 1st, 2020 standard. So So I would ask the committee support in stating that it's its intent that the Treasure Valley facility go first. And beyond that, I'm not really equipped to talk about the other three.
I would just comment, if you'll excuse me, Representative Smith, for people in the audience who may not be aware of this facility, as Representative Bentz has detailed, land acquisition has gone on for 10 years. Getting through the permitting has been not insubstantial. And it's the damnedest thing I've ever seen. The onion packers pack the onions, put them on trucks. They take the onions that are fragile and perishable for a nice little drive up to Washington. They then take them off the truck, they put them on the train, and they drive them right back near the exact packing shed where they first got put on the truck. It is unbelievably cumbersome, wasteful, and inefficient. And so for those of us that had the opportunity to go down and stand on the ground, I would make a pitch to say that this particular project, also in an area of high unemployment and severe challenges from their neighboring state of Idaho, I'm glad to hear that the Fabulous Four have at least contemplated that this one would come out of the chute first. So,
and Senator Johnson, I concur. I was also on that trip when we visited over there, and that was before the devastation of this winter storm happened. So I think it's very important that we make sure that that is the intent. The project is much farther along as well. Senator Monroe.
Yeah, and I absolutely agree. But because it's going forward and because it's readier than the other projects, doesn't mean any of the other projects should be delayed.
Right.
Because these are in different geographical areas, and we could be starting on those that are a little farther behind while we're finishing, hopefully, the project in Ontario. So, you know, it's not like those freeway projects in the greater Portland area where you can't really be doing two of them at the same time because of diversion of traffic.
Thank you, Senator. Representative Smith.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Just to be very technically correct, the Port of Morrow East Beach Industrial Park by far is the most ready to proceed, by far. Now, with that said, I would share with you, if you talk to folks at the Port of Morrow, Port of Umatilla, Port of Arlington, the river ports, they would share with you the project that will have the greatest significance in the region and in the state is the Treasure Valley Intermodal Facility. And if you were to talk to those port managers, port commissioners, they would tell you the most important project for all of Eastern Oregon is that Treasure Valley project, and they would ask for it to move to be the number one project. It's important for folks to understand on that East Beach Industrial Park, the Port of Morrow is the second largest industrial port in the state of Oregon and is experiencing fast and quick growth and will continue to, and it is contributing billions of dollars to the state of Oregon and to the regional economy. But again, I want to emphasize the most important project for Eastern Oregon is that Treasure Valley Intermodal Facility.
Thank you very much. Senator Winters.
I too was on the tour when we toured around, and I would agree with the project in Treasure Valley. I would also agree with Senator Monroe that, you know, you have different phases, and I want to add that I think on a statewide basis that they're all important. You know, the Valley, and I'm one of the regional solutions convener, along with others, with Marion Polk and Yamhill Counties, and recognizing if we don't get our commodities and goods to market, we too have an adverse economy when that doesn't happen. So, and it's for those reasons that we actually too believe that, you know, and you're looking at Millersburg and what have you. So I think looking from statewide, and our tour was about statewide, both congestion and some of those issues. So for me, yes, Treasure Valley, but also recognizing that things can be phased, that we're all in different stages, but they all are really important.
And Senator, all four of those projects are in the first biennium of this bill, so I think they will all receive the attention that they need.
I need to add one more thing, Madam.
Yes, Representative Smith.
Thank you. I'd like to share with the folks, many have asked about rail opportunity. Is it real in Malheur County? I'd like you to know that Malheur County actually received an email from a gentleman by the name of Jason Bisbee, who represents Union Pacific. And one of his requests of Malheur County was specific information as it relates to three different parcels of property, and they expressed their sincere effort to work with the county to make that project proceed forward.
Thank you.
One last further question.
None.
Fiscal has arrived.
Madam Chair, are you ready for a motion?
I'm ready for a motion, Senator.
Madam Chair, I would move dash 10 amendments to House Bill 2017.
Senator Beyer moves adoption of House Bill 2017-10, amendment dated 6/30/17. Is there discussion? Senator Johnson.
Are we even going to discuss the fiscal?
The read-through?
I mean, I understand we're in a hurry, but this is a multi-million dollar bill with a pretty substantial fiscal, and I don't think it's
think
asking too much to chat about it.
Senator, if you would like, well.
Oh, we got a motion. Discussion.
We have someone from LFO in the room, supposedly, right?
I think we'll have to call someone from LFO down, so we'll there stand at ease for just a moment, please.
Was it LFO?
All right, back in session. Gentlemen, thank you for your swift response. You must have been watching. If you wouldn't
thank
mind,
you,
please walk us through this document.
Co-chairs and members of the Joint Committee.
You ran down.
So you've seen the fiscal. It includes a
your
total...
Your name for the record, sir.
My name is Gregory Jolivet. I'm with the Legislative Fiscal Office.
Thank you.
I'm the budget analyst for ODOT, and with me is Nick Herrera, who is the fiscal analyst for this area. So to summarize, the fiscal impact includes total other funds expenditure limitation of $123.47 million, and it includes a total of 51 positions and 36.13 FTE. The bulk of the funding is for direct project costs in Section 71. Those costs total $36.4 million. There are direct project costs in Section 78 for multimodal, and that's $12.5 million. And then there are there is an amount of $51.5 million for transit providers.
Madam Chair.
Senator Johnson.
Could you elaborate on that, Mr. Jolivet? What all does that contemplate in terms of expenditure? I'm sorry, I didn't have a chance to tell you
Senator
I was going to ask you that.
If you give us a second, if you
sure.
if you let me go through the high-level overview, and
Appley.
Then my handy assistant can look into the details when we get to that point. Other non-position-related costs are $10 million. That's included for a study of the I-5 and I-205 projects. There is $3 million for a study of value pricing, and there is a $2.2 million allocation to small cities and counties. The other funding is for personal services and services and supplies, so mostly funding 18-month positions. The fiscal for the bill, as you can imagine, is much larger. The LFO recommends focusing on the first 6 months of implementation and having the department come back to this committee and to Ways and Means to provide an update of its progress on hiring and an update on the progress of the projects that are included here, at which time the legislature would consider authorizing additional expenditure limitation and positions based upon the department's needs. Let's see if we can get into some of the specifics of the direct project costs. Is that what this, Co-Chair Senator Johnson, were you asking specifically about Section 71, 78?
I'm just looking at your fiscal presentation. I don't have this. I can't tell you from memory the section. It was the transit providers piece in your table display on the second
page.
Okay,
transit providers. Thank you. co-chairs and Senator Johnson, that line item.
And your name for the record, please.
Oh, excuse me, Nick Herrera.
Thank you.
That line item corresponds directly to Section 122. The funding in that section is provided by the wage tax increases, and that section requires ODOT establish a grant program, and it provides that 90% a 90% formula for a discretionary grant, a grant program to move those monies to those districts for projects.
Thank you. Representative
Leibman. So, you made a comment about this being the first 6 months, but if I understand those figures, so I'll go back to the transit, the $51 million, does that represent the anticipated expenditure for the whole biennium or just for a first small portion? Because I know there's a delay in when we get the funds, so I'm just trying to understand what that represents.
ODOT has indicated that that total dollar amount is what they believe that they can move out of the door in the first 6 months.
Oh, okay.
Further questions? Senator Boquist?
No. Uh-uh. I'm ready to go to dinner. And drink.
My apologies, Representative.
Co-chair, I need to declare potential conflict of interest. I'm a member of a limited liability company, and that company does economic and business development throughout Eastern Oregon. And there are clients in here who, through no work of my own, are receiving dollars for projects. And I'm going to get that on the record.
Submit that for the record.
I will.
Thank you, Representative Smith.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative.
Thank you. I would like, not necessarily a conflict of interest, but in interest of full disclosure, my husband works for the Portland Bureau of Transportation, who will be a recipient of some of this money.
Great. Thank you. And I just want to submit that for the record as well. Thank you very much.
Motion on the floor.
Let's see, where were we? Chair Senator Beyer moved adoption of the House Bill 2017-10 amendment dated 6/30/17. Is there further discussion? Senator Johnson.
I guess I'm troubled by this process. I was troubled at the beginning with a committee of 14 to try to wrestle with this whole huge issue. We were given a 295-page bill last night. We've only had 2.5 hours to discuss it today. This is a bill for me that has had some unpleasant revelations. I'm struggling right now with how to vote. I would like the opportunity to finish reading the bill. I have to be honest, I didn't make it through almost 300 pages of bill, even when you take out the tables. This is still a pretty heavy slog when we finally got it last night. And so I am wrestling with how to vote on this right now. I feel rather singularly unprepared. While this conversation has been enlightening, it was at a breakneck pace. I appreciate the patience to allow me to ask questions, but I think it's our responsibility to ask these questions. And so four of this panel have had in-depth access to detailed information, professional experts. The rest of us are kind of running along behind you. And I'm just not sure at this moment, as supportive as I have been from the outset of this session for a transportation package, that I'm ready to cast a vote against the backdrop of how quickly this unfolded last night and this afternoon.
Yes, Representative Smith Warner.
Well, I have a few things I wanted to read into the record about the clean fuels section of this. So I don't know if you want me to do that now or in the general discussion. Okay, great. I just want to. I would like to call out the fact that we did find some common ground on the clean fuel standard as a way forward to maintain the core integrity of the program, as well as codify and clarify consumer protections in the rulemaking process, and that are already in the law. Clean fuels will continue to be one of Oregon's signature clean air protections. It allows clean fuels businesses to compete, invest, and grow in our state. I had the good fortune of just having a conversation with one the other day who has a significant investment in Eastern Oregon that sounded with some really exciting technology, and also provide additional protections to consumers during the transition to cleaner fuels made closer to home. One part of consumer protection is ensuring that regulated parties do not gouge consumers under the guise of complying with the program. In Section 162 of the bill, agencies will track the highest cost of compliance to ensure that oil companies are not exceeding that and passing it through artificially high prices to customers at the pump. If that happens, the agency must be able to take action and protect consumers. In Section 163 of the bill, DAS will examine barriers to expansion of clean fuels and make recommendations for how to alleviate those barriers. In Section 169, the agency has the ability to respond to market volatility to both protect consumers and also stabilize the market to ensure that clean fuel businesses are not being harmed and that Oregon remains an attractive marketplace for innovative fuels that reduce pollution and provide consumers with more choice. And finally, in Section 170, the agency will track and report on the progress of the program, including the environmental, economic, health, and other benefits derived from using more clean fuels. Thank you, Madam Co-Chair.
Thank you, Representative. Representative McLean.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I really appreciate and I want to honor folks that were not able to get through the 295 pages last night. I know I have no life, and so I was able to get through them. And even got them, you know, marked up and, you know, and tabbed. But I want to see this bill go forward with the understanding that there are many of us on this panel that want to read more, look more, and make sure that everything that we think we understand, you know, seems to follow through with the goals and also the work and the legal advice that we've been given and presented to us. But I would like to vote today. I'd like to vote this out of this committee today, and then I would like to have the folks that didn't have a chance to do some reading just take the next 3 days to, you know, to feel the leisure of having an opportunity to read longer. But I think it's so important to the people of Oregon that we go forward with this bill that is carrying out the goals that we said we had for the bill at the beginning of this 1 year or almost 2 year process, depending on when you joined it. And it's provided transit resources with basically a fund of funding and a dedicated fund that we've never had before. It is giving safe pathways to schools, and we've had schools and communities and folks all over the state that have requested that we be able to go forward with this bill. We have had a strong commitment, and I have really, because I am representing an area that's part of the Metro 3 County area in Portland, and after going around the entire state and hearing them say that there is a goal from the entire state to help us decrease congestion up in the Tri-County area, and that we need to have the work of this bill to be able to do that, and a true commitment to maintenance and repair of our roads and our systems, that we need to go forward so we don't run out of time in this particular session to get this out the door. And so, you know, we have a motion on the floor. I think that we have ways to make sure that if there's anything in here that we disagree with, if you haven't had a chance to really read through it, and if you have more questions or there are things that we need to fix, that we can do that in that February 2018 session, and that we've started a list of things, of technical improvements that we need to make and that we are committed to making. So, Madam Co-Chair, I just want to thank the co-chairs and the vice co-chairs for the extensive amount of work that they've done, for the massive amount of staff work that's been done, for the work from all of our communities, and also from the Transportation Commission folks that stuck with us all throughout this year or two, coming around the states with us to hear all of the different dialogues about how we need to improve the transportation system in the state of Oregon if we want to continue the economic vitality and we want to continue the lifestyle that our folks are expecting. it's our responsibility to get this package out the door so we can do those projects and make sure that we can maintain the system of balance, transit, safe pathways, maintenance, and modernization projects that can keep us on the forefront and keep us competitive. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Lively.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First, I just want to compliment the four of you, co-chairs and the co-vice chairs, for all the time you spent and the energy putting this together, because it was a massive undertaking. I appreciate it. We all have a different style, and my style tends to be more like Senator Johnson's from a standpoint of how I make policy. And I've been frustrated multiple times through this, and I've shared that with some of you, and you told me I was cranky at times, and that could very well be that I have been. But that does not mean that we haven't reached a point. So from my standpoint, what I'm very comfortable with is holding ourselves accountable along with the department. And so while there are things in here I still have questions about, I don't have any problem publicly continuing to raise those questions as we move forward, approve the bill and move forward, and try to get answers and or correct if we've got to make some corrections to going along. But I'm also just know we've spent enough time on this that I'm ready that we need to move it on. Overall, I'm impressed with the extensiveness of the bill and where we got, given all the journey that we've taken. So.
Thank you. Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have great appreciation for the sensitivity of getting a 200-plus page bill, you know, less than 24 hours ago and asking to vote on it. And that's partially the reality of when you hit the end of the rope. We're hitting the end of the rope. There is no time to go back and change it before we hit the deadline, particularly with a chamber that's adjourned until next Wednesday. But I want to remind you that this has been a process, a very participatory process through the work groups. Most of everything that's here, and I guess I would say everything that's here, is a product of the work group process. The bill that you see in front of you is probably 90% the same that you've seen at the last hearing we had a few weeks ago. The changes to it really fall into three categories. One of those were the changes that were reached by consensus to this group to take things out and alter. Those were honored and done. I think LC did a good job on that. The second piece was with regard to how we were going to deal with congestion in the metropolitan areas. I happen to think that was a good process, but it wasn't one that was acceptable to people who can refer the package, and that's just reality. That's part of the political life we lead. The third one was the length. We were trying to go for a longer funding package, and that was unacceptable to people. We cut it in half, and it reached agreement. And I guess there is a fourth, and that's we started up at the very beginning saying we were going to have to address some price predictability in the carbon or in the clean fuels program. Representative Bence was the lead on that. I think we got to a point where, not that everybody was happy with it, but I think all sides of that hit a place where they could leave. Some of that resulted in the electric vehicles program, which I personally believe that program has the potential of getting us to greater carbon reductions quicker than just the fuel program by itself. So I think those were changes. It's always messy when you do this, but I think it's been fairly consistent to the day. There's some discomfort around projects, but the intent with the projects was to make sure that all corners of the state got something predicted. There's always the sensitivity that, you know, the nature of our state is that majority of the people, not the majority, but a big chunk of them, live in the metro area, and certainly those of us who don't live there are sensitive to that and trying to make sure that we have something like that. There was an attempt to do that. Is it perfect? No. But there's some good projects. I really defend the multimodal projects. I think those are in the spirit of Connect Oregon. There are things that can really potentially, if they're successful, will make big differences in both the economy of our state as well as relieving congestion and making some big changes. So I think we're at a point where it's a pretty darn good package. Not as big as I'd like to have. Certainly doesn't address the overall need that ODOT suggested and the governor's division panel before that, but it makes a lot of progress, and I think it's something we can be proud of if we adopt it.
No, less is more. And the Ways and Means Committee needs to work for two more hours.
Yep.
All right. We have a motion on the floor to adopt the amendment. Clerk, will you call the roll, please?
Senator Girard?
We're just adopting the amendment?
Adopting the amendment.
Yes.
The dash 10 amendment.
Senator Johnson?
Yes.
Representative Lively?
Yes.
Representative McLean?
Yes.
Senator Monroe?
Aye.
Representative Olson?
Aye.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Representative Smith Warner?
Aye.
Senator Taylor?
Aye.
Senator Winters?
Aye.
Vice Chair Bentz?
Aye.
Vice Chair Boquist?
Aye.
Chair Beyer?
Yes.
Chair McEwen?
Aye.
Motion passes. Senator Beyer.
Madam Chair, I would move House Bill 2017 as amended by the dash 10 amendments to the floors with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Beyer moves House Bill 2017 as amended to the House floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Representative Smith.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. College, you know my conflict has been noted and it remains intact. Madam Co-Chair, I want to share with you how much I appreciate you and the three other chairs for your leadership on this issue. I've been here 9 terms, and by far, this is one of the best processes I've actually seen. We've had a chance to tour the state of Oregon, to be on the coast in southern Oregon, to be in downtown Portland, Eugene, Salem, eastern Oregon, all over the state. And it's given citizens a chance to weigh in on this issue. And I think this is the way democracy ought to play out. I compliment you. I am so excited to see improvements to Powell Boulevard. I'm so excited. I was a graduate of Barlow High School, and I know how nasty that street can be. And so I think that's an exciting project. I'm so excited to see the improvements that are going to be made to I-5 and to 205. I've shared in multiple public hearings, and you folks have heard this, that what benefits I-5 and 205 benefits Eastern Oregon. And when we can make improvements to intermodal activity, that benefits the entire state of Oregon. And I think that's phenomenal. I want to thank the truckers and AAA for your input, for really making sure that we created a package that genuinely works for everyone. And I think that's very gracious of you folks to work with us. The pedestrian folks and conservation environmental community, thank you as well. Really appreciate it. That's what makes a good package, is when everyone comes together and has an opportunity to participate. I specifically want to thank my good friend, Representative Bentz. There's no doubt in my mind House Republicans would not be supporting this bill today, but for his leadership. So Cliff, thank you very much for that. I'm going to be pleased to support this bill, and again, to our chairs, well done.
Senator Monroe.
Yeah, I have been a part of this process for more than a year. I think it's legislative work, and I've taught legislature and served in public office for over 40 years. This is legislative work at its best. This is the way it's supposed to be. And it starts with the presiding officers. Senator Courtney and Speaker Kotek did a marvelous job, first of all, of appointing this committee. You know, other than the fact that it's kind of big, it's balanced. And it's not, as you know, the rural parts of the state often accused everything as being Portland-centric. That committee was not Portland-centric. That committee was balanced, and if anything, tilted rural. And because of that, we've got products that affect the whole state, that every part of the state can get behind. And then we took our time, a whole year. We listened to the people. We traveled all over the state and listened, and it was a remarkable experience. You know, coming from the Portland metro area, I always think of transit as something that's mainly needed in urban areas. Not so. All over the state, we heard, in rural areas and urban areas, this has to be balanced. This our whole population is getting older, and we're going to need more and better transit, except for you and me. And so it has to be balanced. It has to have a good transit component. It has to have all the major players on board. It has to be acceptable to business and to the environmental community. It has to be bipartisan. It has to be bicameral and hopefully non-referable. I think we got there.
Thank you, Senator. Any further discussion? Representative Benz.
Thank you, and I just want to make sure I thank staff again, particularly Legislative Council, for their incredible patience and their refusal to laugh too loud at our remark. And I also want to thank my three co-chairs for their patience in putting up with a lot of my to-the-point remarks, maybe too much to the point. And also I want to thank Nick Blosser for his great work out of the governor's office on the low-carbon fuel standard. It's pretty amazing. Without his help, I don't think we'd be here. There's two or three things in the package that are astoundingly beneficial to my part of the state. One's the small city allotment. That's huge. The other is the large county, small population piece. That's huge. And of course, just the extra money to my counties that are in desperate straits. Just the normal raising of funds for them, which is very difficult. And so, of course, the staff, Mazin, Patrick, Timothy, Victor, unbelievable work and patience with us. So thank you so very much for all the really hard work. Without you guys, we wouldn't be here either.
Clerk, will you call the roll?
Senator Gerard?
No, thank you.
Senator Johnson?
No.
Representative Lywood?
Yes.
Representative McLean?
Yes.
Senator Minow?
Aye.
Representative Olson?
Aye.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Representative Smith Warner?
Aye.
Senator Thaler?
Aye.
Senator Winters?
Aye.
Vice Chair Benz?
Aye.
Vice Chair Boquist?
Aye.
Chair Beyer?
Aye.
Chair McEwen?
Aye. Motion passes.
So this will go to both floors. So we, Representative Benz, would you pull Carrie with me?
Sure.
Same on our side.
And Senator Beyer and Senator Boquist will carry.
Right.
And on that note, we are adjourned.
That's a pretty good selection.
We are adjourned.
That's a pretty good selection.